Folks, we'll call the meeting to order. First item that we have, Representative Anderson, who looks very studious, has undoubtedly read all the minutes for the March 13th meeting and moves those minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. First item up is actually going to be House File 1314, which is my bill on Truth and Music. Representative Leon Lilly will take over the chair for us.
Welcome, Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ms. Emerson, did we have a request for this bill to go anywhere else? All right. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1314 be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. You've moved your bill. Do you want to go ahead and tell us about it, sir?
I would be happy to, and as we sit here, I have a witness or two, Mr. Bauman and as well as a Minnesota musician. If you guys would be kind enough to join me up here, I'd appreciate it. How about right here? Mr. Bauman, some of you may recognize from, he was part of Sha-na-na, used to be referred to as Bowser.
I'm still referred to him.
It's hard to picture him this way, though. He's usually got the cutoff T-shirt, and anyway. And Mr. Swenson is a Minnesota musician who's also here to testify in favor of the bill. What this bill does is it gets after unethical concert promoters that take advantage of music fans by using impersonators as music groups to impersonate the originals without disclosing that. This bill does not have a problem with salute bands or tribute bands. If you want to, you know, Representative Anseltz, if you want to impersonate Elvis, you're still welcome to do that.
What it
does, though, is it just simply says that you have to disclose that. If you are going to portray a band to be the Platters or the Drifters or the Coasters, they really need to be. And if they're not, and you're trying to take advantage of music fans, we're not going to allow that. And the Attorney General can step in and get an injunction to stop it. Or there can be a fine levied to try to prevent it. Obviously, the reason folks do this is to try to make a buck in an unethical way. So we're going to hit them in the pocketbook, which is what this bill does. That's in essence what the legislation is about. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Bauman.
Well, thank you, Representative Atkins and Chair Lilly, members of the committee. The operative question here to me is, and to most consumers that represent the audiences in these shows, is how can this happen in America? People go to these shows, they come out of them and wonder how in our country it's possible for people to be up there impersonating other people and get away with it. This is a sophisticated form of identity theft. Imposter groups are duping consumers, they're stealing the names, the money, and the legacy of particularly the pioneers of rock and roll, not exclusively. We've uncovered now groups even from the 80s. A group called Frankie Goes to Hollywood is being knocked off in Miami, and it's, the beat will go on with this. But for the most part, it's the doo-wop era groups, the Coasters, the Drifters, the Platters, who didn't have that much visual identification to begin with. So it's pretty easy to put four or five people up there, call them that group name, and get away with it. The bottom line is that these kinds of imposter groups need to yip 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 boom 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 get a job. You know, just to get rid of the Bowser part of it. Because this is really a serious matter, but, you know, I gotta be Bowser sometimes for a minute. So I'm here to speak in support of HF 1314 because I'm actually the chairman of the Truth in Music Committee at the Vocal Group Hall of Fame, which is in Pennsylvania. We have succeeded in passing an identical bill in 7 states so far all the way through, and 2 states are sitting on the governor's desk. So, you know, we passed the legislature in those 2. The states are Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Illinois, Michigan, Massachusetts, South Carolina, North Dakota, and the other 2 that are on the governor's desk are New Jersey and Virginia. We're fully sponsored in 13 additional states, which include Florida, California, Nevada, Wisconsin, and, of course, Minnesota. And we do expect to have passed half the country with this bill by the end of 2007. The essence of this is that existing law has been manipulated in various ways for around 20 years, and these imposter groups have continued. Just to give you an example, and this is so outrageous, in an interview in 2005, one member of these imposter groups said, quote, "We always had one rule that governed what we'd record and what we wouldn't. Ever hear of a song called Charlie Brown? Did you know that was one of ours?" Unquote. Now, this came from someone who not only never sang one note on a Coasters record, he in fact never met anyone who sang on a Coasters record, period. He went on to say, quote, "Fun is when the Coasters and Platters and Drifters get together on the same stage. On top of everything else, it's reunion time," unquote. It's a reunion, all right, since these imposter groups often work together on these package shows, and sometimes, as Steve is going to attest, switch from one group to the other. It's reunion time. It's a reunion of phonies. So simply put, HF 1314 addresses live performance. There's no implication of recording here. This is about live performance. It states that you need to have an authentic member of the recording group, the group that made the records that made that group famous, on stage in the group that is performing that night. Unless you are the holder of a valid federally registered trademark for that name, because we're very careful not to go into conflict with trademark law. If there are problems with trademark in trademark areas, that's going to be sorted out at the PTO or in other ways. Or unless you clearly and uncompromisingly advertise yourself as a tribute or a salute so that the public knows what it's paying to go see. So this law will finally protect Minnesota concert goers from being duped by imposters and the unscrupulous promoters and agents who foist them on the public without revealing who they truly are, or I should say, who they truly aren't. Finally, on a personal note, I just want to say I have actually been just a really lucky person in this business. I mean, ever since my old group, Sean and I, began the rock and roll revival back in the late 60s, I've been able to live my childhood, you know, kind of as an adult. I play this goofy character, run around in the T-shirt, you know, the sneakers. It's a great way to go to work. But it all stemmed from that when I was growing up, I loved this kind of music, especially the street corner doo-wop sound. And I've been lucky enough to meet every one of pretty much of my childhood idols. And, you know, I'm honored at this point in my life to be able to call them all my friends. And I have to say that to watch them, this is fundamentally a consumer bill. It's about protecting the fans, the audience, from spending their hard-earned money on something that they don't know what they're getting. But secondarily, it also protects the artists. And it's been heartbreaking to watch them go through what they have gone through trying to fend off this imposter group movement, where there were people who were putting out 25 groups of Coasters, Drifters, and Platters. They're all over the country. They perform in Vegas every night. And, you know, they could just, and the same night they're performing in Minneapolis, you know, and Pennsylvania and Maine. It's really a disgrace. And if you want a gut-wrenching experience, try watching one of these baby boomer audience leap to its feet at the end of one of these imposter group shows to honor the legacy, not the performance for that night, but the legacy, the way that music really changed our culture. If you think back, I mean, certainly in my lifetime, the way this music brought races together in America and really changed this country in a very deep way, and these audiences don't even know that they're applauding the wrong people half the time. Any of you, any of us, might have been in that audience and been duped by one of these groups, and the question remains, how can this happen in America? So we're going to stop it, and with your help, please support HF 1314.
Thank you, Mr. Bauman. Mr. Svensson?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say that I've been a band leader. I'm a native Minnesotan. I've been a band leader for 35 years, and I did a lot of backup work with a lot of the groups from the 50s and 60s. I probably backed up over 40 or 50 different artists in my career, got to meet a lot of these people, and it was great. I worked with Bobby V and his band for 2 years. And anyway, it was really fun when we started out and everything, backing up the groups. And all of a sudden, I started to notice a change that some of the groups showing up on, you know, the agents were booking some of these acts, and there was nobody that was related to the original band. And it was kind of upsetting, you know, and I started noticing that the consumers, you know, the fans would say, geez, I don't see, was he in the original band, you know, and they started kind of letting me know that they weren't really happy, but they loved the music, you know. So they were enjoying the music, but at the same time, they didn't feel like who are they? They just looked like four people they'd never seen before putting on the show. Well, so I got a lot of that from my crowds, you know, the fans and people that come see us. And then one thing I wanted to tell you about was we were backing up one of the groups in Great Falls, Montana, and we were backing up the Drifters, and the artist showed up, and we were in the dressing room, and they said, "Who are we tonight?" And I said, "What?" And because we always have the sheet music, and we always rehearse, but they showed up late, so they didn't have time for rehearsal. And they said, "Who are we tonight?" And I said, "Well, you're the Drifters." "Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right." And the other guy poked the other guy and went, he said, "Yeah, we know that, you know," and they just kind of tried to make light of it. And you could just kind of tell that their suits were different. They had two or three different outfits, you know, so it was pretty phony. And I, after that, I got very disillusioned and decided not to back up those type of groups anymore. So basically, that's my experience with them.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Sure.
Any questions, Chair Atkins?
I just want to see if anybody comes to testify against us.
Okay, is there anybody
want to show up?
Anybody in the crowd for it, I guess? I know we have a musician out there because I've watched his show. Eric Escala is quite a musician and maybe good with a guitar, so maybe.
We're so good that there aren't any questions? It's always possible.
Jackins, final word to your bill, sir?
Mr. Chair and members, not only does this protect consumers, but these folks here, they don't, you know, if it was anybody else that makes rakes or shovels or wheelbarrows and somebody stole those, we'd say that's a crime and should be protected against. This is what these folks have to offer, that people are stealing it, and we should stop it. And I'd appreciate your support for this bill.
And if we're, are we done with our portion? Because at the end of our, well, go ahead.
Go ahead. If you, we can't help but,
no,
go
I just
ahead.
Had one more final thing to say.
Please do.
But we have to be done in order for me to say it.
Then you've got to wait because Mr. Swenson has one more.
Oh, go ahead. That's what I meant.
Okay.
I just wanted to add that not only were these imposter groups putting on that they were the real thing, but at the end of the shows, they were even the consumer, the fans would bring their
point.
Old album covers. And these guys were they would sign them as if they were the actual band. So that was really disgusting.
And they do also undercut the pricing and everything. It's just all around a bad thing that, you know, shouldn't be able to happen in our country. So thank you for your support. And if we are, in fact, done.
Nope, not quite, but okay. Thank you very... Oh.
No, I mean with our portion of it.
Yes, sir.
I have to do this at the end.
Please do.
Okay.
Do.
Good afternoon, and Greece for peace!
with that, Chair Atkins...
Renew my motion.
with that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 1314 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much.
Representative Mahoney? Okay. Are you...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I can do what I need to do on House File 740 right from my table, my chair here, if I might. Mr. Chair, there seems to be an awful lot of contention about this particular bill, so I'm going to ask that you lay it on the table at this time so that all parties concerned can stop trying to meet through the representative and actually can go talk to each other. So could we lay this on the table?
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, oh.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. Representative Mahoney.
Representative Zellers.
Was it your intention to lay it on the table indefinitely or bring it up again still today or... I understand your need and I appreciate it. I just want to get a time certain because
I would actually like to bring it back up next week, next Monday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, whatever day we have a committee hearing. In the event that they can't come to some form of agreement, I might have to make one myself.
Well, Chair Lilly, Representative Mahoney, just looking for a date, and I wish you best of luck and godspeed on your mission.
What I'm shooting for.
So that we're going to lay that bill on the table. Somebody stole my cheat sheet here. Oh. Representative Beard. And then Representative Thiessen will. Representative Beard, welcome to Commerce and Labor.
I'd like to move House File 556, Representative Beard, and be recommended to...
General Register.
Be sent to General Register.
Okay, the bill's been moved, and Representative Beard, welcome to our committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have a DE1 Peace in the Valley amendment that I would like to offer, which is why I haven't been here before this. So if I get someone to move that DE1.
Does everybody have a copy of the... DE1 amendment. I'll move the amendment.
Thank you, Mr.
Any questions to the amendment? I'm kind of looking over to see if... Okay, everybody in favor of the amendment? Say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, so it's passed. Representative Beer, we have your bill before us as amended.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair and members, now the bill is now in the shape... that what we'd like to present it. For the last 4 years, we've had an aviation subcommittee in the House of Representatives and in the Senate that have collaborated rather bipartisanly on mostly technical issues in protecting the aviation infrastructure in greater Minnesota. Last year, we passed a bill that off the floor of the House that resulted inadvertently, I think, in a little angst among some of the professionals that have to deal with real estate disclosures. Basically, the Minnesota Bar Association's real estate division and the realtors and the builders had some concern about the language that we had actually passed off the floor, which was model language we actually took from a land use planning company that I've worked with over the past several years that helped develop model zoning ordinances for airports and the cities around them. In respect for the fact that this is Minnesota and we've got a lot of folks that deal in real estate and we have a unique real estate disclosure section of law, I thought it was prudent that we respond to their concerns and that we reach this consensus amendment which you have before you, which will modify the law that we passed last year, still accomplish what the aviation professionals are looking for, which is that folks that move into a neighborhood have a realistic chance of knowing that there is an airport nearby and that the buyer knows that, but still protects the integrity of the system and doesn't result in automatically spawning lawsuits. Mr. Chairman, to speak a little more expertly to it, I have Ms. Susan Diori from the Minnesota Realtor Association. If I could introduce her and have her speak to the amendment for a moment.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Go ahead with your
Members. My name is Susan Diori, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. As Representative Beard described, there was some legislation that did pass last session regarding disclosure of airport zoning ordinances. It was precedential in that it required disclosures above and beyond the best of the seller's knowledge, which has been the typical standard for real estate disclosures in Minnesota. So what this amendment before you would do is essentially repeal the language that passed last session, in that it does not require a seller to actually go out and seek out whether or not there's an airport zoning ordinance that affects the real property. Instead, what this proposal before you would do would require a seller or a real estate licensee to disclose in writing to a prospective buyer that the buyer could obtain information about airport zoning ordinances from the county recorder, which is what the statute requires the ordinances to be recorded. We feel this is a good compromise position. The draft legislation is similar to other disclosure, such as predatory offender disclosure requirements that already exist in the law. So we think it's a good compromise position and would ask for your support.
Thank you, Ms. DeYar. Any questions up here? Is that it? Can I go to the crowd, or do you know anybody against this bill, sir?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I worked diligently to make sure that all sides were heard. The amendment accommodated everybody's requirements, but I might have missed something, so I know of no one else to testify for or against the bill, but I'm certainly willing to.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Anybody wanting to be heard on this bill? I don't see anybody jumping up, so.
Pardon my motion, Mr. Chairman, as amended.
Okay. You want a final word before we... You're good to go?
Well,
Representative Zellers has renewed his motion.
Correct.
To pass House File 556 as amended and to be referred or forwarded to the General Register. All those in favor of the bill as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill passes. You're on your way to the General Register.
Mr. Chairman, members,
happy
thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen? I'll move that House File 1656 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health Policy. Welcome, Mr. Thiessen and Representative Thiessen. Do you want to present your bill, sir?
Thank you, District Chair. This bill is addressing a concern I think people have had because of recent incidents about lead jewelry and causing some health problems, particularly for children. It's actually being brought forward by manufacturers of lead jewelry who recognize this is an issue that we need to address, and it's based on a proposal put forth at the federal level by the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, which has kind of set forth some guidelines and some testing mechanisms. A lot of this bill has to do with how the scientists are going to test how these how the lead content is, and I don't claim to understand what all that is, but it's based on this federal Consumer Product Safety Commission. I think it's a great step that we can pull people together on this. I do have one amendment. I'd like to take out subdivision 6, which is the rulemaking authority. The department tells me they don't need this authority, and it'll save us a step. So I can't move it, but I'd ask someone to move that subdivision 6.
Okay.
If line 7.28 to 7.30 be struck.
I'll move that. Any questions to the amendment as being offered? He wants to remove subsection 6. It's on page 7, starting at lines 2.27 and through 7.30. Any questions or any questions to the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment. Amendments adopted, and
I do have some witnesses that probably could do a better job than me of explaining exactly what we're trying to get at here. So if we could go
yes,
to
sir.
That, and then maybe
go ahead and invite up your witnesses,
Mr. Chairman. As the
Representative Zellers,
as the witnesses come forward, and maybe this is I see Representative Dabney's not here yet, but maybe for Chair Atkins, this is another one of those division consumer division bills that maybe got the. wink and a nod and came up here. Just a concern from our committee.
Chair Atkins?
Just a concern from our committee members again that these bills that say literally say consumer in the title are not being seen in division. And just a note and maybe an explanation from the chair as to how they passed.
Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, we were trying to sneak one by you on this one, and it just you caught us. No, I visited with Chair Dabney about it, and there's certain ones that merit two hearings, and there's others that, and no offense to you folks, but there's others that we thought that this erudite group in the whole Commerce Committee, that if it was given a good hearing here, that might suffice. And if, in fact, that's the case, I'd like to move it. If that's not and it becomes highly controversial, which I don't think it will, then we certainly still have the opportunity to move it to division and then back here so you can hear it again.
Representative Zellers?
Chair, thank you, Chair Atkins and Chairman Lilly. And I was going to bring it up about the other bill, but I'm not stupid. I'm dumb, but I'm not stupid. I'm not going to do that with Bowser in the room. No, and I understand there's peace in the valley on these. Again, Mr. Chairman, a note of concern from my side of the aisle and some of these bills not being heard. And the committee that Representative Dabney, I'm sure, is very proud of and would like to be put to full use.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Representative Thiessen, do you want to introduce your guests? Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Michael Gale, and I am the executive director of the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. And with me today is Ms. Dee Moss, who is a supplier of jewelry, a resident and a business owner in Minnetonka, Minnesota. And we're both here to address you and to answer your questions. 3 years ago in California, an issue was raised of companies, retailers, who were in violation of a law in California known as Proposition 65, which required labeling on certain products. And the retailers were not following that law. An environmental group then brought an action, as they were entitled to in California. The retailers brought their suppliers into the question, and 2 years later, after negotiations with the California Attorney General, the environmental groups, the retailers, and the suppliers, standards were reached, which were determined to be very safe for the lead content in jewelry, both for children and for adults. We were very pleased at this, and unfortunately, the event occurred last year in Minnesota, where the child had access to a trinket that was a premium item. It was not made out of the metals that the jewelry industry uses. It was not plated or coated or protected in any way. And ultimately, that child died. And, of course, there was great concern throughout the country. And this only encouraged the industry to make sure that we determine what is safe for the public and do our best to see that it is enacted as law, both at the state and the federal level. The law with these standards has passed in California and in Illinois. It is pending, in addition to Minnesota, in Michigan, Indiana, New York, and it has been proposed in several other states as well. We are also working with the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, and they have taken these same standards, which are in Representative Thiessen's bill, as the basis for establishing rules at the federal level. Unfortunately, the CPSC is supposed to have five commissioners. They only have two right now. They don't have a quorum. And until the president appoints and the Senate confirms another commissioner, the CPSC cannot promulgate any new rules. So we come before you to answer your questions, to tell you the history of what's going on, both of our experiences, which we don't want to tell you how many years, but total about 75 years in the costume jewelry and fashion jewelry industries, and to encourage your support for 1656. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gale. Representative Thiessen, do you have...
I'm going to just represent to the committee that the retailers have expressed some concerns, but we have word that we have an agreement worked out, and it's coming to my committee next, and I assure you that we'll get those words put in, but we're not quite there yet, but we do have a concern. They've expressed some concerns, but we've worked out a deal according. They're their representatives.
Okay.
So we'll do it in the next committee.
I see happy smiles.
All right.
And often that's a good thing.
So if the committee would indulge us to move ahead with this, and I will deal with it before the next committee.
Thank you. Is there any questions?
Be kind of straightforward with everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Is there any questions up here from members? With that, do you want a final word, or I'm just going to... Okay. The chair renews his motion that House File 1656 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill?
Resounding.
Thank resounding.
Aye.
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 Thank you very much for your time. And
thank you.
Thank you. Representative Osteen in there? I don't. Otrumba. Okay. I read it wrong. Senator Osteen, but no. Representative Otrumba, please come up. The chair will move Senate file number 112 to recommend it to pass, and where to the general register, I believe.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Charma, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Okay, this is a consumer bill. This issue came from a parent and was shocked that there was no law for body piercing in Minnesota. We regulate tanning at 16 years old and tattooing with a note 18 and over, but we had no statute that said anything about piercing. I have a testifier that I would like to have you hear from.
Go ahead, sir. Please state your name for the record. And
okay. My name is Derek Lowe. I'm
Just 1 second. Did you want to ask your question, sir?
Representative Trump, I just want to make sure I heard correctly. I know that body piercing and tattooing, for example, go hand in hand in a lot of establishments, and it's the current state of the law that we require what you're asking for in this Senate file for tattoos, but we don't for body piercing. Did I hear that right?
Representative Trumba?
No, actually, we require a note with a tattoo, and tanning, you have to have permission from your parent if you're under 16, okay. But we have no regulations when it comes to body piercing.
Okay, so just, or Mr. Lowe can
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear about it. Right now, if a 16-year-old came in and wanted a tattoo, you would require a note today under the current law. But if they came in and, say, wanted their nose pierced, a similar note wouldn't be required. I just want to make sure I'm clear about what we have.
Yeah, I mean, that's how the law...
Sir, we didn't... Please state your name, and I'm probably to blame for this.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Go ahead and state your name. And
my name is Derek Lowe, and I'm a senior piercer at St. Sabrina's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's currently how the law reads. That's not, and I think one of the distinctions here with this particular law is that the proprietor or the piercer would be required to actually see the parent sign, you know, the consent form, whereas the tattoo law, I believe, only requires a note. It doesn't necessarily require the parent to be present. There just has to be a note granting permission.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Sure. Again, my name is Derek Lowe. I'm a piercer at St. Sabrina's in Minneapolis. Been piercing professionally for a little over 12 years. I'm a former board member of the Association of Professional Piercers. And certainly this is an issue that we deal with on almost a daily basis. We have body piercing, as I'm sure you're aware, is very popular. and lots of young children are interested in getting pierced, and a lot of times they'll sort of try to circumvent their parents and achieve that, get their piercings done however they can. And presently, you know, there is no law that requires them to have any sort of parental consent on a statewide level. We're in the city of Minneapolis. We fall under their jurisdiction. We are required to have parental consent. And there are other cities and counties that have similar regulations, but nothing on a statewide level. It's just, I guess, from my perspective, it's a bill that makes a lot of sense. It's going to protect, keep a lot of children from getting piercings done unsafely. And it's not so much, in my experience, the issue of actually physically having the piercing done that is the issue, but it's the establishments that are willing to do that without parental consent are typically motivated exclusively by money. Their bottom line is their primary concern. And as a result of that, they cut a lot of corners increase their bottom line. And typically that occurs in health and safety issues or health and safety concerns. So you run the risk of transmission of communicable diseases and things like that if the procedure's not done safely and appropriately. So as a professional in this industry, I would like to support this bill and ask for your support as well.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Representative, do you have... are you aware of any opposition or anybody, other testifiers? Or
Mr. Chair, no one's contacted me.
Okay.
And there are a lot of states that are already doing this, so... and we are doing it with other, like, tattoos and with tanning, even, so...
Thank you, Representative Tremba. Anybody in the audience that would like to be heard on this issue? I don't see anybody. Anybody up here that would like to be heard on this issue?
Ready to go.
Okay. So any final words, Representative Tremba?
Just thank you for hearing our bill, and hopefully you'll support it.
The chair renews his motion that Senate file 1112 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is on the way to the General Register. Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Lowe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Those scenes here? Joe wants to come. Welcome back, Chair Atkins. Or are we going to have some more singing, sir?
No, unless Ms. Perry Weaver does it, I don't think so, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1364 be recommended to pass, and I'm not aware of any request for it. Ms. Emerson, is there any place else this bill needs to go? So I'd recommend it to pass be re-referred to the General Register.
Chair Atkins has moved his bill. Go ahead, Chair Atkins.
And Mr. Chair and members, the only thing we might sing here would be Kumbaya. This is everybody's come together. As former Chair David used to say, there's peace in the valley. This is a good consumer bill. It does... builders contract or building contractors insurance. Anybody that's familiar with this area knows that this has been an issue for a while. It sets certain limits and allows builders to go out into the market and get the insurance that they need to pay the claims that they have. I am joined by the builders who are in favor of this. They can talk to me a little bit about the challenges that they faced the last few years and about where and why this bill is necessary.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Welcome, Ms. Weaver. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We represent the residential construction industry here in the state. My members build about 80% of the residential construction here in Minnesota. In the past year, we have put about 36,000 new units on the ground here in Minnesota. We have 13,000 licensed contractors throughout the state. Every one of those are required to have general liability insurance. What this bill seeks to do is further define what general liability insurance is. Over the course of the last 5 years, the general liability insurance market for builders has deteriorated. The content of the coverage has deteriorated. We think that's a public policy problem on the back end. So this bill just further defines what general liability insurance is and what coverage it should have for builders.
Thank you, Ms. Weaver. Chair Atkins, any?
Mr. Chair, that's all I got. I'm not aware of anybody that's in opposition to it, but I suppose we can look around. I don't see anybody charging up to testify. Representative, I think it's a different bill. You may have problems with Representative Dabney.
That one's yet to come.
With that, Mr. Chair, I guess I just renew my motion that House File 1364 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Chair Atkins has renewed his motion. Any questions to the motion? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. You're on the way to the General Register. Thank you,
Mr. Chair
Atkins and
Thank
Ms.
You,
Weaver. Mm-hmm. Representative Fritz. Representative Fritz, I'll move your House File 712. Be recommended to pass. And re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr.
Do you have an author's amendment? I can't talk there.
Yes, I do. I'm going to bring up my testifier. And I don't have the amendment in front of me, Mr. Chair. You have? I don't have a copy of the amendment.
Does everybody have a copy of? Does everybody up here have a copy of Representative Fritz's A2 amendment? Someone give me a nod or something. Go ahead and...
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I do have the A2 amendment. You want to adopt that?
I'll move the A2 amended, okay. Or amendment.
Right.
Any questions to the A2 amendment?
Chair?
Representative Anderson?
I don't have that amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fritz, can you go ahead
can
with
go
your
ahead?
Bill,
All
and
right.
then we'll get the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, the bill before you, House File 712, requires all health care facilities in the state of Minnesota to adopt a written safe patient handling policy by July 1st, 2008, to achieve the goal of minimizing manual lifting of patients by nurses and other direct patient care workers. By utilizing safe patient handling equipment by January 1st, 2011. The bill before you today is the result of many negotiations between the parties affected, and I have an amendment which we just adopted, reflecting further negotiations that have continued to take place since the bill's last hearing. Mr. Chair and members, by investing in this program, we will reduce healthcare workers' injuries and will in turn reduce workers' compensation costs, and it will keep healthcare workers at the bedside where we need them. And finally, it will keep patients safe. I have a testifier that I'd like to turn it over to now that would give some testimony.
Okay, Representative Fritz, we're going to back up a second. Okay. Does everybody have a copy of the amendment now? Is that still... Representative Anderson, do you have a copy? Any questions to the amendment? I've moved the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, so we have... Ms. Barnes?
Thank
you. Okay. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your...
My name is Cindy Barnes.
Thank you.
And good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for this opportunity that I have to testify on behalf of the Safe Patient Handling Bill. After working 32 weeks and more as a nurse for nearly 40 years, I retired in 2004 at the age of 62. I would have liked to have continued working longer, but I have been living and working with chronic back pain since 1968. Initially, the pain was intermittent, but the injury was progressive, and the last 20 years were increasingly difficult, and I have rehabbed many times. My body couldn't take anymore. Despite the pain, I continued to work those years because I was a single parent and had to support myself and three sons. That is very typical of many nurses in the state of Minnesota and other places. Even though I was able to continue working, my injury was a life-changing event. It's the simple things in life that were affected by the injury, like being able to cook and serve a meal. I worked most of my career in intensive care, in fact, 30 years. On a typical day, I would have two patients. Good body mechanics were not remotely possible, and you can imagine the awkward postures that one can get into with the variety of machines and equipment that we have. I was not surprised to read that the average nurse lifted 1.8 tons in an 8-hour shift, and we have done the math. It's true. Good body mechanics do not, and we all know now that they do not reduce injury. Every day that I worked, I knew I was one lift away from the end of my career. In addition to being an intensive care nurse, I was an MNA union steward at United Hospital in St. Paul. As a steward, my primary assignment was to work with nurses who had been injured on and off the job and help them navigate through the work comp and disability insurance processes and with issues related to return to work. United Hospital, as part of Allina, made a real effort to get people back to work. Nonetheless, there were dozens of nurses over the years that could never go back. Good nurses that should never have been lost. All of them wanted to return to work and were devastated when they could not continue to be a nurse at the bedside. One day, I had worked with three nurses who had anterior fusions, and at the end of the meeting, I noticed a sign outside the lobby. It said, 300 and some days without an injury at the construction site on United Hospital. I remember thinking how ironic that those guys out in the girders and cranes are safer than I am at work. In the 2004 Minnesota Workplace Safety Report, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry listed workers with the most frequent OSHA recordable injuries. Of the 14 occupations listed, nursing assistants are number 2, RNs are number 7, and LPNs are number 12. Essentially, the report says healthcare workers have higher rates of injury and more severe injury than most other workers in the state. The association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, understands that employers did not intentionally hurt their employees. They relied on a standard industry practice that we now know was not effective in preventing injury. We are not here to place blame, but rather to focus on what we can do together in the future to ensure safe working conditions in an industry that faces an acute shortage of workers. MNA has worked extensively with Allina and with the Hospital Association to bring a new program, Safe Patient Handling, to Minnesota. We have seen significant success with employers such as Allina, Mayo, Fairview, Bemidji, and some nursing homes. We commend those who are changing, but we need the rest of the employers to follow their lead. We have asked for grant money in this bill to assist some employers with startup costs associated with implementing this change. It's not a common occurrence to have a union ask for financial assistance for employers, but we believe it is in the best interest of patients, employers, and workers, and will expedite the changes we need. Nurses and other healthcare workers are not getting any younger. The average age of a nurse is in the mid-40s. The shortage of nurses and other healthcare workers is a continuing issue that does not get better when the people in short supply are injured. It seems to me that when a nurse is injured, it is one more patient and one less nurse, and the cycle continues. Thank you for hearing the concerns of registered nurses in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Representative Fritz?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there might be some testifiers in opposition, and if they wanted to come and testify, and we could come back as to
okay.
If that's it.
Come on up, whoever.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sarah Nosneski. I represent the Minnesota Medical Association. We have over 11,000 physician, student, and resident members across the state. We are not opposed to the intent of this bill, and I want to make that very clear. However, we just learned about a day or two ago that the intent of this bill is to include physician offices as well. If you read the bill, lines 2.3 and lines 2.17, talks about licensed health care facilities. And in statute, that means a hospital or a nursing home. And tonight I want to let you know that covering all clinics, well, we have some concerns about covering all clinics. I'll leave it at that. Mainly because lift equipment or lifting patients may not be frequent in a lot of different clinic settings. Say a psychiatrist's office or a dermatologist's office. In many cases, a dentist's office. We're also concerned about the significant cost once the equipment is required to community clinics to comply with this. So Representative Fritz has been very kind with us. We are going to have some additional conversations and try to reach some consensus about how to move forward. But I did want to let the committee know that we do have concerns about the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And anyone else? Mr.
Representative Anzelk, do you have a question? Or maybe we should wait. Or is it related to right now?
It's related to this testimony.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, could you tell me again the membership of your association?
We represent physicians in the state, so medical doctors, students, and residents.
I distinctly heard you say students before.
Medical students can be members of our association, yes.
How many of them are students in your association?
I can't tell you offhand, I'm sorry.
So this really is an association of physicians?
Primarily, yes.
Second question. Do you have any knowledge of what lift equipment would cost and the varieties of lift equipment and the applications of lift equipment and what kind of lift equipment would fit certain applications and certain kinds of venues where this would be necessary if this bill were to move?
Yes, we have been in conversation with the author about that, Mr. Chair, members, and we are looking to come to some agreement about what would be required where. But we do have concerns even about the expense, while minimal for something like a community clinic or a free clinic, with squeezing reimbursement rates, how they would come up with funds to do that.
Please, one more follow-up. I'm really not interested in free clinics. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in physicians' offices, and I'm trying to get a handle on what kind of cost we're looking at.
Of the machines?
Yes.
You can buy...
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Chairman. The machines, the Hoyer lift, for example, is approximately $4,000 to $7,000, I believe, a piece. New. Used, you can get one for about $1,200.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. I think we have one more person on the list, Ms. Myers. Oh, Representative Simpson, sorry.
Mr. Chair, we'll take this testimony first, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think I have an error here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Ms. Meyer was going to substitute for me, but now I'm able to be here. So for the record, my name is John Lips, L-I-P-S. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Lips.
Long-Term Care Trade Association, and here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative, which consists of my organization and the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. Just briefly, Mr. Chair, I did submit a letter on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which the members should have in their packets. And our position is that the bill... In a year or a time when nursing homes had lots and lots of extra money, this would probably be a good idea. But our position, as well as the concern that was with respect to some medical clinics, is that it constitutes an unfunded mandate for nursing homes. And that issue, I know, is primarily a financial issue, maybe not the primary concern of this committee. But as our members say, there are no free choices in nursing homes. Anything, even if it has a small incremental cost, anything that a nursing home has to spend money on means they can't spend it on something else. Nursing homes are in a historically bad financial position, and so it's important to our members as this bill moves forward that we go on the record and say that to the extent the bill is not funded in such a way that would allow nursing homes to have the money they need, our members have to speak in opposition. The cost of the equipment is part of the issue, but also in nursing homes, There are some unique storage-related issues. They're sort of mundane, perhaps, but you can't store one of these lifts in the hallway of a nursing home. It would be a potential regulatory problem. And we also, in some bathrooms, the way they're designed in these nursing homes, which are old buildings, some of these lifts couldn't even be moved into the bathroom without a structural change to the building. So, Mr. Chairman, I've taken more time than I needed to, but we just wanted to be on record about that and also indicate we have worked with the advocates for the bill and with Representative Fritz, and we'll continue to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Let's maybe just both of you stick for a second here. I think Representative Simpson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is probably for the author.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Fritz, I appreciate the fact that you're looking out for nursing homes and looking out for the well-being of the staff, but I have seven nursing homes in my district, and every one of them are struggling constantly, fighting for dollars. And this, to me, looks like really an unfunded mandate, and I think we've just heard that. More paperwork, more time away from the patients. As I talk to my people and I go in these nursing homes, that's one of the biggest complaints they have. Is we have so many mandates, we have to do so much paperwork. As I look through your bill, I look here under subsection 2, we're going to have to go into each facility and get a safe patient handling committee, creating this new committee and having this on form. Does that mean then when the inspectors come around, they're going to have paperwork on every patient on every day that they have people there?
Representative Fritz?
Thank you, Representative Severson. Well, they do now. And
Simpson.
Simpson. They have, they do now, and they do have safety committees up and running in the facilities now. And this would not be, and believe me, having worked in the nursing home for 40 years, I don't want any more paperwork either. But this bill, procedure actually that I look at would enable me to spend more time at the bed. Helping the resident, repositioning the resident, doing the cares that are on paper that I am charged to do, and could and would be able to spend that time. It's a time-consuming process to turn someone who is paralyzed, elderly, and ill, and it is difficult to do that with my body only. So. Is there paperwork? There's always paperwork in nursing, and there's probably going to be one more form. But it really is not that much more. And the committees are already up and running, and this would be an adjunct to that committee.
Mr. Chair, I look at this, and it's saying we're starting another committee, so I'm not going to argue that with you. But most of our nursing homes have these Hoyer lifts in them already. Do they have regulations that say they're not allowed to use them?
Well, no, they don't have regulations that say they're not allowed to use them. And
so at this point, why wouldn't they be using them? If they have a patient that's a problem, a patient that needs help, wouldn't they automatically use this lift?
They would if they could. We need more than one lift per 62 people. And the lifts that I have two lifts for 62 people. One is battery-operated, and the other is where I used a lever, and that was the $1,200 one. And we keep that for a backup because oftentimes the battery is dead because we're using it so often. We need more. We need at least two, one for 32 patients and one. So we need to address that. We don't have enough equipment, and some homes have none.
Okay. Well, Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Fritz, I think it's a great idea, so I think you should have a bill to introduce money to buy Hoyer lifts then, if that's the problem, instead of just putting more bureaucracy into our nursing homes and putting more paperwork into them. Let's buy them the equipment they need so they can solve the problem. This bill will give them the opportunity for a one-time startup, but then they're going to end up with the constant maintenance and the constant paperwork to keep this thing going forward, and it will cost money.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm Betty Shogren. I'm the health and safety specialist at Minnesota Nurses Association. Right now, the type of equipment that we're talking about has an average life use of 10 to 12 years. The return on investment for a piece of equipment, the worst case scenario is 3.4 years, and more frequently, it's less than 2 years, generally around a 15 month
with the return on investment for the cost of that. There are numerous studies out there, documented studies, that when we introduce a patient handling program, which is more than a Hoyer lift, it's essentially a program to determine what are the needs of each resident in relation to mobility assistance and appropriate standards of care, that we have remarkable reductions in staff injury. At a previous hearing, and I'm sure it's on the record, we had a safety officer from St. Louis County talk about the fact that in the first year after introducing the safety equipment in the program, he had a 75% reduction in work comp costs. He had a 50% reduction in patient injuries and resident injuries in the nursing home. That he had staff turnover rate that dropped from a very significant number down to something that was single digit. The startup costs are a problem, but once you get past the startup costs, the program pays for itself multiple times over. And there's it's very well documented. I'd be very happy to provide that documentation to the representative who had the question.
Thank you, Ms. Stolgren. Representative Simpson?
And to that point, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, thank you. You prove my point. They need the money to buy the equipment. They don't need the regulation, and they don't need more paperwork. Thank you.
Representative Burns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo the same point that Representative Simpson made, I think, pretty well. I am concerned about unfunded mandates, especially on our nursing homes. And I do hear from a nursing home administrator in my district who has that concern. But there's a question I wanted to ask you, and it was something brought up by the representative from the MMA. And I wonder, and I understand why you want this bill to pass. It's for employee safety, and it's a very good purpose. But I'm concerned about maybe it being too overbroad, affecting every physician or every outpatient clinic. And I'd be worried that it would affect, an office of a dentist, an optometrist, a chiropractor, a podiatrist? What about a psychologist?
Maybe. The answer is maybe. Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Chair, the program requires the employer manager of the place to assess their patient population and what needs does that patient population have. If the assessment is that they don't have any need for equipment to help with that person's mobility, the answer is they wouldn't really have to do anything. They'd have to have a plan to deal with it if they had new patient population that came in with needs with that. But we had testimony in a previous hearing from the MS Society where I believe the person said that in a physician's offices that sometimes the environment is so difficult that he estimated that 60% of the women with MS in the state of Minnesota couldn't get a pap smear because there was no way to get them on the table for the examination. With that, not having equipment sometimes can create a very serious issue with substandard standards of care for different patient populations. We don't think every office has to have ceiling-mounted lifts and 82 pieces of equipment. We do think that in a physician's office it might be reasonable to assume that they would have one room that was equipped to handle patients who had those needs. And as a matter of fact, the ADA, I mean, they can spend a lot of money in litigation. If they had a patient who couldn't be cared for because they wasn't equipment, they could sue because they failed to make a reasonable accommodation to their disability in a public structure. And so I think that what we're saying is let's do what's reasonable. Let's make the employers do the assessment and develop a plan and implement the plan to do that. And it may be they don't need anything, and it may be they need very minimal pieces of equipment, and it may be if their patient population requires it, that they may have to do something more than that. And we think that that is not only a worker issue. As registered nurses, we're very concerned about patient safety and appropriate patient care, and our bill addresses that as well.
And to that point, Mr. Chairman, I do have another testifier who could just comment on that, if you would allow. Please.
Okay, go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record and keep it brief. We've got a couple other bills on the agenda tonight.
I understand, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Yulin. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. A part of our interest in this bill is actually in the area of clinic offices. I think one of the things that we see for people with multiple sclerosis is that when they get into a clinical setting, it is very difficult, as was mentioned before, for women in particular to be able to access pap smears. And we know that quite a number of women have not been able to access that. We also know that for many people, they have not been able to be able to get the access to be lifted out of their chairs because a lot of times there is not enough staff available to provide that transfer out of their wheelchair and onto an examination table. And so that is part of the reason why we feel it is very important to have this type of an assessment be available so that way they can determine, is this a clinical setting that's going to be seeing people with multiple sclerosis or people with other disabilities where a Hoyer lift or another device of that type would be very useful in helping to transfer that person so that they're able to get the proper medical care that they need to receive. Also, what was mentioned earlier in a previous question relating to dental offices, this is a huge issue, actually, for people with multiple sclerosis, is that for many of them, they do not even get access to dental care because they physically cannot get into the dentist offices and be able to have a transfer be able to work for them to be able to get into the chair. And so part of what we are hoping to be able to do here is to be able to look at, is there an assessment, is there a way that can be dealt with in that type of a setting?
Representative Burns?
Yeah, and just my follow-up comment is everyone should have access to health care. I feel strongly about that. And everyone needs to comply with the ADA. My concern is that with rising health care costs that affect us all, skyrocketing health care premiums and our state budget being squeezed with health care, I would be concerned that if we're going to do this, we fund it so we don't just leave our health care providers to... If you're a small dentist in a small rural town and you have maybe one or two chairs, can you afford adding a lift? And do you even have the room in your office to do that? And that's what will be my concern, and I hope you would continue to work on that as we go forward.
And thank you, Representative Burns, thank you for that. And I do have those small dentists, and they refuse to see those patients. And that's been a problem as well. So I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman and members, and just wanted to reiterate that this is a small investment and a huge return on the safety of both the worker and the resident. So I appreciate
Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
We have one question from Representative Atkins, and then I'll come to you, sir. Mm-hmm. Representative Atkins? Mm-hmm. Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, first off, I applaud your bill. It's well intended. It's a good bill. I expect to support it. I just wanted to confirm specifically that it doesn't apply to dentists. It doesn't seem to read that way, but I know that note got passed around. I was curious if the intent was to apply in that setting as well, or if that was beyond where the bill was going.
Well, originally,
Representative Fritz,
in the bill, it does say on line 1.15 and 1.16, actually 1.16, outpatient clinic or physician's office. And we didn't specify dentist, but we did. This does say, to me, it says outpatient clinic, and that would be a doctor's office. And of course, dentist is part of, is a doctor, and those are the needs that are out there that we haven't been able to meet. Because of this inability to lift these folks out of their wheelchair into a chair or onto an examining table. Now, I've had those experiences in my personally as a nurse. I would go along in the car or the ambulance with the residents, transport them via wheelchair in and out of the clinic, and the doctor and I together would lift the resident out of the chair onto the table. With lots of difficulty, and that continues today. And most of the time, the docs don't want to see them in the clinic setting. They would just as soon wait and see them on rounds in the nursing home or hospital. So there is a need out there, and the dentist as well. My dentist in my town don't see them. We send our people to other dentists that we know that has a lift in another town. So it's.
Chair Atkins, follow up?
No, thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simpson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I like what your initial plan was when you started talking about doing something in nursing homes. But when the farther we get into this and see now we're in the dentist's office and we're in the clinics, your $2 million is kind of a pittance, and I hope everybody on the other side is thinking about how many clinics you have in your district and how many dental offices you have in your clinic or in a district and how far $2 million is going to go. So I think if you're going to continue working on this, I think you better look at the dollars you have in here, or otherwise it's strictly an unfunded mandate. And secondly, I'd like to know if the Dental Association is aware of this, and if the clinic, the Medical Clinic Association is aware of this, because this is really expanded from what it started out as.
Representative Fritz?
Well, we're working, we're negotiating, and we'll see where this bill goes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The bill is on the way to finance, and so there will be a lot of eyes that will be able to take a look at it. It's quite a big committee, I understand. Any other final questions? Seeing none, I suppose I didn't look on. Look around, Lila. The chair renews his motion that House File 712 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Walker.
She was a breeze.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Welcome. The chair moves that House File 1844 be recommended to pass. I don't know, to the General Register. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
I do apologize that I wasn't here. I was doing another bill. It's just that time of year. Let me walk through the bill briefly. House File 1844 is a hair-braiding bill establishing a registration for individuals that get professionally compensated for hair-braiding. Subdivision 2 gets into what the definition of hair-braiding is and what hair-braiding is not and what type of simple hair-braiding devices that are utilized. On page 2, subdivision 3 gets into the requirements. Specifically, like I said, targeting individuals that are compensated as a profession, trying to get them to get instructions that would not exceed more than 30 hours total. That would include health, safety, sanitation. This curriculum would be developed by the Minnesota Barber Cosmetology Examiners. And Mr. Chair, I do have an oral amendment, but I will say, members, that if you would have asked me a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, would I be carrying this bill, I would have laughed at you. This is a true bill of compromise. This is something that I have fought with this gentleman who is about to testify for the last several years, making sure that Representative Gunther knew exactly how I felt. As someone who, as you guys know, has their hair braided on a regular basis, initially, when the proposal and the bill was getting moved, it actually didn't just deal with individuals that were being compensated. It would have dealt with my niece. It would have dealt with the individuals that, the little girl down the street that gets, that braids the boy's hair just to get $5. Yeah. And so after a couple years of compromise, this is the bill that's in front of you. But Mr. Chair, I do have an oral amendment if you mind. Don't mind.
Please do. Can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On lines 1-9, after the dollar amount 15, if you could strike annually. And on the following page, on page 2, line 2-3, after the words 4, if you can strike initial.
We need more than that.
And I'll incorporate that into my bill.
The chair will offer the amendment that on that we're striking on 1-9 annually, and on page 2, striking the word initial. Any questions to the amendment? Representative Zellers?
Sure, and Representative Walker, the striking on 1-9 annually, so is it just a one-time registration then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers.
Representative Walker.
Thank you very much. Good idea.
The chair will move the amendment. Any questions? Further questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Mr. Chair, seeing the time limit that you have, I'm not sure if you want my testifier to testify. If there are any questions that members may have, I'll stand for those instead.
Yes, please. Go ahead, sir, when you're ready.
Oh, we were saying we were going to yield for the testimony if there's questions.
Oh. Any questions for... Thank you. Give me some cover. Representative Burns. Sorry.
Thank you. And this is probably a question for the author. I had not been aware of this issue until it came up in the papers a couple years ago. And there was a lawsuit involved, I know. It looks like with your amendment, it's gone from a one-time registration, or from an annual registration to a one-time registration. I know generally when we have licensing boards, it's generally for public health and welfare, and they tend to follow the licensee from year to year to make sure that they're still qualified. I know most boards have minimal requirements for continuing registration. Did your amendment change that so now once you're in forever?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burns. I'm going to let Mr. Hurst answer that, but just to keep in mind, the real intent of the bill is to make sure that the hair braiders that are in salons getting compensated as a profession have the basic information, the importance of sanitizing a comb, the importance of making sure that you have safety, making sure that you know where to keep scissors out of the way and things of that nature. So that's really the purpose of this, wanting to make sure that there was some oversight, and that's where the initial fee came from. But I want Mr. Hurst to follow up also.
Mr. Hurst?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Please identify yourself for the... Oh, you were. Sorry.
Quite all right. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst, and I represent the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, which was previously known as the Minnesota Chapter of the National Cosmetology Association. To your question, Representative Burns, you are correct on the fact that there was a lawsuit, I believe, 2 years ago, the result of which resulted in complete deregulation of this type of service in the state of Minnesota. I would like to state that the previous requirements for hair braiders that only practice this aspect of cosmetology, I believe, were excessive. To acquire a license in cosmetology, one needs 1,550 hours of curriculum. Usually, that 1,550 hours does not even touch on hair braiding per se. However, as a result of the lawsuit and complete deregulation, the pendulum sort of swung from one extreme to the other. And in cosmetology, we certainly want to make sure that the basic health and sanitation requirements are at least understood by the practitioners, and that is the reason behind this legislation coming forth. Additionally, as to annual registration, since the focus of this is to try and make sure that these practitioners do get the 30 hours requirement, it seems unnecessary for them to come back every year just to do a registration. Once the initial requirement is met, there should not be a need for an ongoing registration per se.
Representative Burns?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Representative Walker. It looks like the $15 fee would be to cover the cost of registration. What kind of costs are we looking at for a person to take up to 30 hours of instruction at an accredited school or through an individual?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative De La Forest. That part is still yet to be determined. One of the things that we wanted to make sure with the bill was that we didn't put a lot of constraints, and that the individuals that know how to do this the best, their accredited schools. Some of the accredited schools are right now trying to figure out a program. And Mr. Hurst, you want to respond to that too?
Yes, and in addition, Representative De La Forest, not only are accredited schools allowed to offer this type of curriculum, but certainly individuals who the state board deems appropriate to also teach this type of curriculum would also be authorized. And to that degree, I think competition is good, and certainly an individual versus a school could certainly see a reduction in the cost for that curriculum, and I think that makes the bill even better.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman, I just want a follow-up question. Thank you.
Representative
Walker. Training could be up to 30 hours, obviously more than one day of instruction. And since Representative Seifert isn't here to ask the question, I will on his behalf. Are there any guarantees, you know, for folks out in rural Minnesota? There may not be the economies of scale in a particular rural area to justify somebody getting into the hair braiding instruction business, either an accredited school or an individual. So, you know, is there a possibility under your bill then that somebody, you know, 300 miles from the Twin Cities might have to get in their car and drive and get a motel room and things in order to undergo the instruction that would be required under your bill?
Representative Walker, Representative DeLaForest. One of the things is I'm looking forward to the day that the hair braiders come out to rural Minnesota, because then we know that we've changed Minnesota completely. But until that piece happens, one of the things that when the bill was initially brought to me was the effective date. And initially, Mr. Hurst wanted it this year, and we did talk about the hardship, and that's why we moved it back to next year. For the current professionals right now, making sure that if we had to require them, if it would be 20 hours, did not want them to have to incur the 20 hours in 1 week, because that's a financial hardship. To your question, and particularly, it's the same type of situation that we currently have as it relates to cosmetologists. It's one of the things that we as a state have to figure out how to build the economy of rural Minnesota so we can have some competition so everyone doesn't have to come down to the city.
Representative DeLaForest. Any other questions? Seeing none, where am I? The chair renews his motion that House File 1844 be passed as recommended to pass as amended and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Representative Walker. Your bill's on to the way to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Atkins?
Oh, boy. Oh, we're out of here at 6. Somebody else is coming in here.
Chair Atkins, would you like to...
Yes, Mr. Chair. And thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, I will move House File 1359 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And that may surprise you a little bit that it go to the Finance Committee, but there is an amendment that will put the bill in the shape it needs to be, and there's a finance provision in there, and I want to make sure that they get their bite at the apple. So that would be my motion. I would then move the A1 amendment, which should be in your packets. And I'll explain the A1 amendment a little bit so that you're on the same page. And it's not a surprise. It's a rather lengthy amendment, but essentially what it does is there's a practice within among certain less than ethical chiropractors. The overall bill deals with auto insurance, but there's some chiropractors that have what are called runners. And they go out and they chase after claims, they knock on people's doors, and the Minnesota Chiropractic Association supports this, I believe, and I think the insurance industry is going to be here as well, that they support this. Everybody, as far as I know, supports this. If not, I'm sure they'll come up here and tell me otherwise. But I would move the A1 amendment so that we at least proceed in the fashion that the author would like to move it forward.
Chair Atkins has moved his amendment. Any questions to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Chair Atkins, your bill is before us as amended. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Minnesota No Fault Act is what we all buy car insurance for. You buy it, you pay for it every 6 months or so. It gives you certain medical benefits and wage loss benefits if you're involved in a car accident. Many of those provisions simply haven't been updated since, when it went into effect in 1973. So what this bill does, and I'll give you sort of the high points of what it accomplishes, and then I do have a member of the Minnesota No Fault Standing Committee who doesn't, not here to with any axes to grind. She is on the Standing Committee trying to recommend updates and so forth, and she'll be here to testify as well and answer your questions. But the high points are that, among other things,
If you're involved in a car accident right now, you have $250 in wage loss benefits. So this would be if I get in an accident, even if it's my fault, that's what no-fault insurance is. I crash my car. Currently, I have $250 in wage loss. That was pretty good, you know, 30 years ago, but it hasn't been updated in a long time. What the bill does is that moves that to $500 per week. By the way, this does not increase your insurance amount. You still got to have $20,000 in coverage, so it shouldn't jam up premiums or anything like that. It just says that you can get $500 a week. Funerals have gone up in expense. There's $2,000 that's available under current law. This would move that up to $5,000. It assures that prescriptions and medical appliances are covered in addition to medical services, things like a cane, a walker, casts and slings. It restores the right of consumers who own more than one car to stack their coverage to automatically get that coverage unless they turn it away. And then it adjusts the replacement services loss from $200 to $600. So if you need somebody to come in and take care of your home, do the things around the house that you can't do because you're injured, it, again, recognizes that there's been a little bit of additional cost in the overall cost for that. Again, it does not increase the $20,000 amount, so it shouldn't have any effect on your premiums. It just sort of updates where things are at. Mr. Pender does have an amendment that he's working on, I'll pass out shortly, that tries, I of the understanding that the Insurance Federation has an issue with the bill that I am trying to get at in language that hopefully will accommodate them as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask that Karen Kingsley join me and provide you with her testimony with regard to how this updates Minnesota's no-fault law.
Welcome, Ms. Kingsley. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Karen Kingsley. I'm here as part of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. I also am, as Representative Atkins indicated, a member of the No-Fault Standing Committee, and we oversee no-fault disputes. I'm not here representing the Standing Committee. We're a neutral body, but I was requested by the trial lawyers to be here. I agree with Representative Atkins. This is an update. For example, I also represent, I've done plaintiff's work and defense work, and I represent injured people. $250 a week has been the number for wage loss for, I think, since the 1980s. My clients who are injured in an accident, if there's significant injuries, I have clients who are losing their houses because $250 a week does not cover their housing expenses, let alone food and that type of thing. So we're asking for that to just catch up with inflation. The same with funeral expenses. I don't know of anyone who can have a funeral for $2,000, let alone $5,000, so we're asking for an update. And as for the medical devices and appliances, we wanted clarification because issues have come up. We've had people injured who their doctors have prescribed a different kind of mattress for them because they need something to help their back. That's been denied under the Act, and so we want clarification that things like canes and wheelchairs are allowed. The issue about stacking, many times a client is injured and will come to me and say, well, I have four vehicles, and I'll say, well, because you didn't know enough to ask about stacking, you didn't stack your policy, so you only have coverage under one of them. This simply requires the insurance company to educate the person so they can make the decision, do I want to pay the extra premium for stacking or not? Normally, it's a very small amount to stack your policies, and it provides you with a great benefit. But most of the clients who come to me had no idea about this, so this would require them to be given the information so they can make the decision. And then the adjusting of no-fault benefits, the replacement services from $200 to $600. Again, if you're injured and you can't do your household chores, this just catches up with inflation. We have clients injured who, because it's a primary caretaker of children, have to put the children in daycare. And $200 a week doesn't cover it. And I believe it's been $200 a week since this bill was passed in the 1970s. So we're just asking for an update on that, and we're asking that House File 1359 be passed.
Thank you, Ms. Kingsley. Mr. Johnson? Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
It's a trade association that represents virtually all of the auto insurance companies that sell virtually all of the auto insurance sold in Minnesota. And regretfully, I'm going to take a slightly different tack. This is, from our industry's perspective, this is not an updating minor changes of the law. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask the committee members to consider a couple of questions. If there's one comment that companies and agents hear on a daily basis from the constituents, from the residents of Minnesota regarding their auto insurance or even their household insurance, it's that I am insurance poor, how can I pay less? That is the question, if there's one that's spoken of more than anything else. And House File 1359 is not going to help the answer to that question. Unfortunately, and we've had debates up at the legislature over the last 3 years, trying to get at items of the Minnesota no-fault auto system, and frankly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, our no-fault auto system is broken. It's not working. It's not doing what this legislature intended when it was passed in 1974, and because of those failures, Minnesotans are paying in their car insurance considerably higher premiums than surely most of the surrounding states and many states around this country. And I know this perhaps isn't the bill or the time, and I welcome the opportunity to show those failures of the no-fault auto system. But Mr. Chairman and committee members, you know, we have probably 675,000 cars operating on Minnesota today that don't have car insurance. 675,000 cars operating, and the people do not have car insurance. But why is that the case? Well, there are a lot of people that can't afford it. Anything that we do that increases the premium is going to affect. And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman Atkins, regretfully I didn't get a chance to chat with him prior to this, but probably it's not a surprise. This is not a simple adjustment of the weekly amount. When the weekly maxes are changed, the utilization of the benefit changes, and it will affect premiums. That's just the truth of the matter. There's no question about that. When language is added regarding the scope of the statute and its new wording, is going to affect what's paid in the system. And frankly, so Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think we need to look at ways to help consumers. I have no question a vote for this bill is going to be a vote for higher auto insurance premiums. It just flat is. It cannot be spoken. It cannot be concluded any other way. There's language in here, a tripling of the replacement, a doubling of the disability, a mandating that we're going to stack benefits. Today it's optional. Frankly, consumers today have the option to buy higher benefit amounts. Auto insurers sell more wage loss coverage. Do people buy it? No. Why? Because they want to minimize the premium. Consumers today can buy higher basic economic loss TIP benefits, higher levels. Do they buy it? No. Why? Because they're trying to afford the policy. So from our industry's perspective, we sell this stuff. Trust me. Companies want to sell coverage, but people are asking for relief to pay less. The last section of the bill, unfortunately, actually even makes us late in paying a bill when we haven't received the bill. I'm struggling to try to figure out how a law can be drafted that says we have to pay in 30 days and the providers can treat for 6 months, batch bill. We get the bill 6 months later and we've been late for 5 months. I'm certain that Chairman Atkins didn't intend to put a penalty on us when we don't have the bill, but that's really not the significant issue. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'd urge you no vote. This is going to increase the premiums of every driver in the state of Minnesota who's got a car carrying a policy. I assure you that's what's going to happen. So we'd like to see some of the benefits updated, but frankly, we'd like to see what's broken in the no-fault auto system take place. And the day, not today, another day when we'll have the debate about what's broken, what we can fix. I'll end with this. States around the country are getting rid of their no-fault auto systems. After this October, when Florida goes away, there'll be nine left. Florida residents are going to have a 16% reduction in premiums on October 1 when their no-fault law goes away. The 3 years before that, when Colorado's no-fault law went away, Colorado residents' premiums dropped 25 cents. We're talking about real money in the pocketbook of the drivers of a given state. So, Mr. Chairman, I urge a no vote. We think this is not the time to do the reforms in this bill and think it'll have that negative effect on consumers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think we're all very much listening to this whole discussion. I'm starting with four cars on insurance as of tomorrow, so of course my son doesn't know that yet. Hopefully he's excited. Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, I'd offer the A101 amendment, which I believe has been passed out. This, Mr. Johnson raises a good point with regard to the language is a little clunky on the bottom of what would be the third page and the back page. What we're trying to get at, and I'll read it to you and explain it, essentially the operative language is, however, if the insured notifies the insured that it's denying benefits, the insured need not continue to provide the insurer with proof of the bills, losses, or expenses. Right now, there's this unusual requirement that even though you've been denied, your insurer now has said, your insurance company basically said, you're not getting any more benefits, you're cut off. You've still got to allegedly still send in all your bills and expenses, and it's a pain in the butt both for the insurer and for the insurance company. It makes no sense at all. And so this language, and thank you, Mr. Pender, for finding language that accomplishes. We weren't trying to make them late after 6 months and 5 months and all of that. And the only other point that I would make is that, while I certainly hold Mr. Johnson in the highest regard, we're not changing the package of, in terms of the overall amount of benefits that are available to people. I thought about updating the $20,000 that's available in medical benefits and the $20,000 that's available in wage loss benefits to, again, update the numbers. It was a considerable amount of money some years ago. It's still a decent amount of money now, but it doesn't recognize what people are earning today and how much medical bills cost. So I was going to update that as well, but I was afraid Mr. Johnson would come and say it's going to increase your premium. So I left that part out, and he still came and said it's going to increase your premium. So maybe I'll amend that and put it. No, I'm not. But I'd appreciate your support. It's not going to impact your premiums. You're not buying any more coverage than what you bought before. It should stay exactly the same. Mr. Chair, I moved the amendment. I don't know if I can't remember if it was voted on or not. But
any questions to the amendment as moved by Chair Atkins? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
So we have the bill before us as double amended.
It is.
If you will.
And Mr. Chair,
any questions to the bill, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, as I'm looking through this bill, I'm looking at line 10, where the added language says, and items that provide relief from any injury. You know, for me, anytime I eat chocolate or ice cream, I definitely feel better from any injury I'm experiencing. So I'm just curious, you know, what are we talking about here? And I would feel more comfortable if there was a little more clarity, if it said, you know, items that are recommended by a physician or, you know, something to that extent.
Chair Atkins, we all could use some chocolate.
Anderson. Well, first off, we can make a legislative record that it does not apply to chocolate and the like. I'm relatively comfortable with the language. That's the first time that concern has been brought up. And I would suggest to you, I'm happy to work with Mr. Johnson to figure out what language might, because we're talking about canes and walkers and that sort of thing that right now is a little bit unclear as to whether it's covered or not. And I just want to make sure that obviously people can get that paid for. And I will assure you, if you'd like to work on it with me and make sure we don't include chocolate and stuff, you're welcome to do that. But I think if we work with Mr. Johnson and some of the folks that are involved in No Fault, we can certainly come up with language that works with that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other? Representative Burns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. I don't know if you know this, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many days on average someone collects the compensation for loss of employment when they do file a claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burns, no, I don't.
Okay.
And I could hazard a guess just anecdotally, but I probably shouldn't. I'll try to find out though and get you an answer.
Okay. And the reason I ask that question, if people don't go up to the full amount and the full $20,000 worth of coverage, and we have a doubling of the amount that you receive in lost wages on a weekly basis, you know, updating that number to a more modern reality, it seems to me that would be a pretty direct correlation to an increase in insurance rates as Mr. Johnson proposed. So I'd be interested in knowing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Burns.
Representative Chair Atkins.
It's a good point. We'll find an answer. My anecdotal evidence is that most people either don't have significant wage loss claims a day or two or three, or they have very significant wage loss claims. And what happens is they end up upside down. They're eventually going to get their $20,000, but in the 2 or 3 months or 4 months that it takes them to get there, they are so underwater with their bills and so forth because they can't keep up. They're getting $250 a week. I think that might even be more than or less than what legislators get on a weekly basis. But $500 is still not what most people are earning, but it's a little bit more in the ballpark.
Thank you. Any other further questions? Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd request a roll call on the bill.
Okay. Roll call's been requested. And Chair, any further questions? Chair Atkins?
Chair, as long as if there's no other comments or questions, I'd renew my my motion that the bill be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. Chair Atkins has renewed his motion. The clerk will take the roll. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Atkins?
Aye.
Anderson?
No.
Enzo?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Dabney?
Aye.
De La Forest?
No.
Dominguez?
Aye.
Johnson?
Yes.
Knuth?
Aye.
Lilly?
Aye.
Mahoney?
Aye.
Mullery?
Aye.
Paulson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Simpson?
No.
Tilbury?
Yes.
Zellers.
Nope.
Motion prevails. It's 11-6. Congratulations, Chair Atkins. Your bill is on the way to Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One other item before I think what we're going to do is take a break before we take up Representative Sertich's final bill. I believe that's the last bill on
yes,
the
sir,
agenda.
Yes, that is correct.
Chair. House File 1314, which was passed earlier, was the first item on the agenda. In visiting with Chair Mullery, before this bill leaves committee, I wanted to recall the bill with the permission of members and strike out it's probably varied, I know, folks, but essentially what we'd be doing is striking out the unique penalties that would apply in this instance. It allows for a civil claim, an injunctive relief, and just go with the traditional misdemeanor. As Representative Seifert on the floor today quoted, and that way it would go straight on to the general register. My motion, Mr. Chair, would be to recall that bill and recommend it to pass. I guess before that, I would need to move specifically that lines 2.16 through 2.33.
Chair Atkins, do we? I think we vote on the recall first.
We should
vote to reconsider. So we have a motion to reconsider. House File 1314. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have your bill back before us, sir.
And with that in mind, I would move to delete lines 2.16 through 2.33.
Chair Atkins has moved to remove sections. Sections 4 and 5 on page 2. Representative Zellers, question?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as long as we're staying within the boundaries, there is some penalty on there. Unfortunately, we don't have Bowser to with some sort of in-between music, but I understand the motion and no problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions to the the bill before us, the motion. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I would move that
bill
the House File
passes.
1314 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Assembly.
Chair Atkins has renewed his motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes again. No music. Sorry, Representative Zellers. And now we're going to stand in recess to the call of the chair.
Folks, we'll call the meeting back to order. Next up on the agenda this evening is House File 464, Representative Sertich, School Employee Statewide Health Insurance. The chair will move that House File 464 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Representative Sertich, welcome back to the Commerce and Labor Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to be back. Hopefully this bill will take 3 minutes as the last one did, maybe a little longer. Members, House File 464 is a school employee health insurance pool. It's been around for a few years, but I see there's some newer members here, so I just want to briefly go through the bill. What has happened in public education, but it happens everywhere in the state, is healthcare costs are rising out of control. And we've tried a few different remedies, but status quo is not working. So bring before you the health insurance pool, covers all eligible employees, and has a public corporation board that's equally distributed between the school employee unions and the school board association. And, Mr. Chair, I believe I have a testifier because it's better to hear from them than me. And if they want to come down and briefly talk about their issue, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Sertich. At one point, I thought you said eight testifiers.
No.
Just a testifier.
A testifier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sertich.
Okay. There you are.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, I am Kim Davidson. I teach second grade in Crookston, so I had a journey down here. In fact, just to let you know how nice the weather is here, we can't let school out at 11:30 because we had 5 inches of blowing snow, so I was glad to get down here. I serve as the Ed Minnesota PAC chair as well. I come today because I want to speak in support of this bill, but more importantly, to ask you please not to tack on any provisions that would enable people to opt out. I'm not going to want to stay brief. I know it's late. You want to get home. You have other things to do. I'm not going to share the stories that you've heard. We do have teachers in our area that qualify for Minnesota Care, can't afford the insurance that they have. I'm not going to go into a lot of those stories. But what I'm going to ask you to consider is I want a pool that everyone has equal opportunity for. Not those people that can opt out. I taught in Anoka Hennepin my first 11 years. I do have experience with large districts. I know they also support this bill. I come from a district of 110 teachers. We support this bill. The fear I have is with opt out is if you let the larger districts stay out of the pool, my district and what smaller ones will build that pool. We'll have the rates that we believe will be there. And as soon as it's tougher for the larger districts, they're going to come in, and everything's going to change for us as well. Please let this go through as a clean bill. I have been open the last few sessions for any other alternatives to our plight, but I've heard none. I have spoken with my leaders from my area and from everywhere else, asking what else can be done. It's a federal problem. It's a problem here. We need to start somewhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sertich, anyone else that is here to testify in favor of the bill?
I don't believe so. At this point, but I know it's late, so.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this bill? Good evening. Welcome back.
Mr. Speaker, members of the committee, Representative Sertich, my name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and the Commerce Department is very, very neutral in this bill. But I want to explain a couple of things. I'm providing a little handout here on solvency. The the Commerce Department makes sure that all healthcare entities that are regulated in Minnesota, along with the Health Department, are financially sound. We want to make sure that the entity can pay all their claims. And the bill does require the Commerce Department to review and approve the six policy forms that this pool will create. We'd like to have the opportunity to also make sure that the reserves that the pool creates is adequate, and again, to make sure that it's properly funded to assume their risk. We want to make darn sure that this pool doesn't financially fail in the future. So there was an amendment put on by Senator Scheid in the Senate version that gave us an opportunity to take a peek at the reserves once they were formulated by the pool, and we just want to have that opportunity again to make sure that the pool is adequately funded and like I said, to be able to pay all its claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to this bill? Don't all race up at once. I know that there's... Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Wagner, and I'm here today to urge you to oppose the House File 464, Mandatory School Employee Health Insurance Pool, in its current form. As a former human resources executive and a mother of children in public schools, I am concerned that this bill lacks parameters that will truly address health care cost drivers. I have been responsible for benefits plan design and contract negotiations and have seen firsthand that the most successful benefits plans involve ownership by the direct entities they serve and a strong emphasis on wellness and preventative care. This creates a motivation for judicious use of health care that is not only financially driven, but is also driven by creating a vested interest in the success of the plan through ownership of it. True long-term savings in health care costs come from changes in lifestyles and health habits. I would urge the committee to consider the following. Number one, the plan designs are very loosely defined. They're not parameters for wellness or parameters to encourage judicious use of health care. Where are the cost savings? Number two, initially the bill calls for six plans. How do we know that all six of these options will remain in place on a long-term basis? Number three, benefits plan design is very complex. In creating plans for a workforce of over 20,000 lives, ranging from professional engineers with doctorates to hourly paid manufacturing employees, I employed several expert consultants to assist me. Are there provisions to ensure that the board appointed for this, when they develop these plans, they'll have that benefits expertise at their hand? Are there funds to pay for such consultants? Number four, moving to a self-insured plan, which has been discussed as one of the eventual alternatives for this, requires stop-loss insurance to protect against catastrophic claims. Has this issue been examined in regard to this pool and the plan designs discussed? Would such insurance be extremely costly for a pool insuring 200,000 lives? Number five, the bill doesn't clearly define reserves to be established for this pool. Where will the funds come from? Who will be responsible for guaranteeing the solvency of the plan? In short, there are many unanswered questions about this bill. In a year when both the legislature and the governor have stated that funding education is one of their top priorities, it would be extremely disappointing to see funds intended to maintain Minnesota's position as a leader in public education be squandered on unknowns and maybes and I don't knows. As a parent, I truly care about seeing my children's teachers and all children's teachers properly insured with affordable health care. In closing, I'd like to ask you to visualize the plight of this board that you're establishing. 14 people trying to determine viable plans for 341 school districts. Based on my expertise, when I see this, I see chaos. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Ms. Mays, Kathy Mays, Minnesota School Board. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Kathy Mays. I'm a mother of two boys. I'm a member of CASE. We've been down here lobbying for about 3 years. And I am a member of our school board. I am concerned, I have three concerns, which you listed out a few, Lisa. The cost. I have continued apprehension about the cost of a loosely spelled out program. We have been told that there is $150 million needed for reserve, which no one seems to be able to pinpoint. Who is going to be funding that? Is it going to be your responsibility? Is it going to be that board's responsibility? Or will it be the school's responsibility? I, too, am concerned about the incentives and how robust the plans will be. In Minnetonka, we have incredible wellness programs. Our teachers are involved in developing newsletters, blood drives, health meetings, eliminating sugar. They all are wearing pedometers. How robust are the plans going to be? We've got teachers that are saying yes and no to a plan that they don't even understand. I'm also concerned about bargaining and local control. In 3.1, it states that there are six initial health plans to be offered. One's all-encompassing, one has a high deductible, another four are to fill the middle. School districts will bargain with their teachers and staff to choose a plan or plans. But I wonder about the word initially. Could there be a reduction in the options and thus giving us less local bargaining control? Now, on our board, I always like it when someone comes with an idea. Don't just complain. The best idea is a voluntary pool with solid plan design administered by knowledgeable insurance personnel. I also ask that you send this bill to the K-12 Finance Committee for its members to review as it impacts kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mays. Next on the list, Scott Cronquist. On deck, I have Dennis Fend or Greg Schwab. Whoever's next, please be in the on-deck batting circle. Go ahead and take announce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Cronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Appreciate the opportunity to say a few words, and I will try to be very brief because I know all of you have heard a lot about this issue. AMSD, while we certainly share Representative Sertich's concerns about rising health care costs and appreciate his willingness to tackle this issue, is opposed to House File 464. Our primary issue, members, is the mandatory nature of the pool. We do believe that a voluntary pool can succeed. In fact, we think there is ample evidence to show that it can. The original report from which this proposal emanated talked about two options, a voluntary option and a mandatory option. It did say that you're likely to have less cost savings under the voluntary option, maybe up to 1.5%, but nowhere in the report does it say that a voluntary pool is not a viable option. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman and members, other states have, in fact, successfully implemented voluntary pools. We know that pooling can help, that it does make sense. You do gain purchasing power, but there are also limits to how big you need your pool to be. And we have several school districts that have been very successful in implementing cost control mechanisms by controlling utilization, by implementing disease management, wellness programs, etc. And so obviously they have big enough pool to achieve those results and have had successive years of 0% premium increases. I'll just leave it there, Mr. Chairman. We would ask that the committee and members would consider just a small amendment, and that's to make this pool voluntary. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cronquist. Dennis Fend? Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Dennis Fent. I'm currently the president of the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale Teachers Association, the Teachers Union. I've also been a teacher since 1973. Tuesday evening of this week, I was at a meeting called by Senator Saltzman with district and union officials from Stillwater District and North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale District, as well as with representatives from Ed, Minnesota. Both Stillwater and North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale are once again in the process of making large budget cuts. Senator Saltzman requested the meeting because she wanted to know what effect passage of this mandatory statewide health insurance would have on these districts that she represents. She obviously doesn't want to do anything to make cuts worse. If a district turns out to be a loser, as many will be, one can only wonder how much deeper the cuts will have to go. A number of straightforward questions were asked at that meeting that I'd like to share with you, And if you have a desire to follow up with Senator Saltzman, I'm sure she'd be happy to share and confirm my explanation. The first thing asked was, is there a plan design for this proposal? The answer, no, there is not. The second question, what will the premium cost be of each of the plans? The answer, we don't know. What will be the cost to Stillwater School System if they are mandated into this plan was the third question. The answer, we don't know. Fourth question, what will be the cost to the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School System if they are mandated into this plan? Answer, we don't know. What will the cost be to other districts around the state since the study states that there will be significant winners and losers? We don't know the answer to that question. Now, my question then to you is, are you sure you want to mandate this on to all school employees and all school districts? One would find that hard to believe with all of the unanswered questions. If indeed you do need to mandate something, let me suggest that you mandate instead adequate funding on the formula allowance, full funding for special education. In my district, we subsidize special ed to the tune of $5.9 million just last year out of the general fund. Also, fully fund all day, every day K. My district this year is spending $1 million to maintain all day, every day K. And, of course, they are not being reimbursed for that. So, again, I would simply say if you need to mandate, please consider something other than this mandatory statewide health insurance plan with nothing but unanswered questions, and instead look to providing the funding that is needed for our students across the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fenn, and to all the testifiers, please stick around. We may have some questions for you afterwards. Gray Schwab, former member of this fine body, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Gray Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. The Minnesota School Boards Association is a private, nonprofit organization that provides technical assistance, cost-saving programs, advocacy training, research and referral for all Minnesota public schools. Membership is voluntary, and all of Minnesota's public school districts, including many charter schools, have elected to become our members. MSBA supports quality health care for our employees at a fair and competitive price. And this bill does not ensure that basic health care or any cost savings. MSBA has strong concerns about the financial solvency, glaring lack of defined financial reserves, and simple employee health care protections. MSBA has strong opposition to this plan. So consider these points, members, please, before you vote. This mandatory state government-run pool advocated in this House file will cost more, not less, which will likely draw resources away from classrooms. The mandated insurance pool has no reserves and only self-evaluation reports to the legislature and the Department of Commerce. This would be the largest pool in Minnesota with 200,000 lives. A mandatory pool eliminates competition, a major driver in controlling skyrocketing costs. And once again, as Mr. Kuhnquist indicated, the Brennan and Anders report said the difference between a mandatory and voluntary pool was 1.5% of the savings. Lastly, members, this bill does not control health care trends, the real drivers in these increases: an aging employee population, prescription drug costs, high-tech procedures, and the high cost of insuring retirees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. I think we're going to stick around. We'll take testimony first and then be asked back for questioning. Next up, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education, at the risk of being, piling on, I guess. We, too, as a management school organization, do believe that this is the wrong direction to go with the health plan. We represent 59 school districts located in both the metro and non-metro areas, some of the largest school districts in the state, and we have a strong position against this bill. I can't really add anything to what Ms. Schwab and Mr. Kruenquist said. I simply want to go on the record as saying we, too, concur with their assessment of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Please come on down.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Graffel, Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'll be very brief. We continue to oppose the bill and urge you to vote against it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other testifiers, please come down. I have Mr. Straczynski, Mr. Johnson left. Any others that would like to come down and testify?
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today. I represent the Minnesota Regional Service Agencies. They're formerly known as the Service Cooperatives, or XSUs, in the old days. Just a quick note about, and we do also oppose this particular piece of legislation. Our organization was created by the Minnesota Legislature over 20 years ago to help school districts pool resources for a variety of efforts, purchasing significant items and services at discounts. We've done that. One of the businesses we got into years ago was insurance. We do insure 155,000 lives in our pools today. About 75,000 of those happen to be pools with school districts. We write insurance for 285 school districts, 60 counties of the 67 in Minnesota, 185 cities, 170 other local units of government, housing finance agencies, what have you. That's 700 different governmental agencies in Minnesota that we provide insurance through, and these people can buy insurance on the open market. They're buying from us because we're cheaper and we're getting the best bang we can for the dollar. That's significant. 155,000 people in our pool. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that lots of testimony here, but in the interest of time, you should think if you have to mandate something, mandate opportunities. I think that's really, really important. I think mandate an opportunity for service cooperatives, mandate opportunity to state that those employees should have a C-gift sort of plan or what have you. That's the way to do those kinds of things, I think, as opposed to mandating people into a particular larger pool. Frankly, bigger is not better, and that's one of the – that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to save any money. You mandate opportunity you have a collective bargaining process at the local level. That's what drives insurance costs. They determine the benefits, they negotiate it for that at the local level, whether you pay cash in lieu or what have you, a variety of things. But at the end of the day, that's what drives costs. That's choices. This legislation before you does not change that approach to providing health insurance. It mandates people into a larger pool. The savings you can realize there are not going to be realized. And one of the concerns we certainly have, and you ought to have, at the end of the day, ask yourselves, if we go forward with this particular initiative and it doesn't work, the service cooperatives are out of business. What's the alternatives at that particular time? I'd like the committee to seriously think about that. We have the same comments and concerns with inadequate reserve levels in this new statewide pool. You should know something else about us. This bill puts the taxpayers, some taxpayers, someplace at risk. Currently, under the current market-driven system on a voluntary basis, we have reserves in all of our seven regional pools, and the taxpayers are not at risk. The service cooperative pools, our reserves, are at risk, or our facilities. We go to a statewide pool, government-run, if there's shortfalls or insolvency issues, who's at risk? Some taxpayers are going to have to be at risk. The example certainly is CGIP, your own insurance program that you belong to. When reserves are inadequate and they're short of dollars, they come back to the general fund. That number is over $25 million in recent years. You paid. That doesn't happen in our insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Straczynski. Any other? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Why am I here? To ask a question, I guess, Mr. Chairman and committee members, why do we have those blue books behind Chairman Atkins? That's why I'm here. I represent commercial health insurers, not the big three. The diminishing number, they're right, less than 1% of the market share, but we are actually living in those blue books, which you all have passed through the years. There's a full one book by itself that regulates insurance companies, health insurers, rates, premiums, solvency, investments. House File 464 has three lines that deal with all those issues. And, Mr. Chairman, my question is, the day is going to come where we're going to have a book-burning party on that blue book, really, because Minnesotans, legally and for saving money, are fleeing the blue books, are fleeing the regulations that you all have collectively passed over the last 40 years, because we've deemed it of some significance to regulate for solvency, investments, reserving, pricing. I guess my question is, Mr. Chairman, maybe we should let the rest of the Minnesotans buy health insurance under entities that have three lines in terms of the ability of premiums, pricing, reserving, and maybe we go, let's do it one way so that we have the same playing field, if you will. I think those statutes are there because we've deemed it important that the insurance companies are there when the claims need to be paid and adequate monies are collected. And frankly, the healthcare playing field is so chopped up, and it's getting more chopped up, that I think we're reaching the point of greatly diminishing returns. Because lastly, Mr. Chairman, those systems set up there actually don't work when we exit so many Minnesotans. Fewer and fewer Minnesotans are covered by those blue books regarding to healthcare. And as we shrink that number, the mechanisms, MCHA, the social purpose mechanisms we have, actually don't work. They will fail. And so we'll be at these tables trying to figure out a way to pick up the pieces when they fail, and they will, because they're not going to work. So, Mr. Chairman, I put in a plug for the blue books and hope that we can apply them to Minnesotans buying health insurance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Stick around. We may have you up for questions. Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Preferred One, a health maintenance organization and health plan owned by Fairview and North Memorial Healthcare Centers here in Minneapolis. I'm also speaking tonight on behalf of the 8 nonprofit health plans in the state of Minnesota under the guise of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the bill that you have before you tonight is a very, very important piece of legislation. We believe that this bill increases the risk of insolvency for the people who will be covered by this proposed pool, and the proposal does not assure adequate funding of reserves. The number one reason why so many pools have failed in Minnesota and the rest of the country is because reserves are not adequately funded. According to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, reserves should be set at 20 to 25% of expected claims to ensure financial viability. The actuarial study done for this proposal recommends setting aside less than 10% of the level of reserves. If this pool becomes insolvent, you've heard several others ask, who will pay the claims? The school districts, the states, taxpayers. The legislature is currently dealing with the problems of underfunded accounts of the Minneapolis teacher pensions and others. This would be added to that list. This proposal does not ensure that there will be any money available for the first day of operations. Minnesota Chapter 62D, if you want to run a health maintenance organization in this state, requires an initial net worth requirement as a condition of licensure. This requirement has been left out of House File 464 and is contrary to the actuarial requirements imposed on other health plans and insurers that operate in the state of Minnesota. This legislation does not state how we will establish those reserves if, in fact, the proponents move from a fully insured product to a self-insured product, as they have said is their intention. Presumably, each school district will be assessed an amount to include reserves. Schools that are currently fully insured are not required to pay into a reserve account because they are not at financial risk for a claim. Having to fund a reserve pool will be a financial hardship for many school districts. Additionally, the proposal does not address how to protect school districts that currently receive their health insurance from service cooperatives from losing the reserve payment that they've made to the service cooperative. The service cooperatives will need to keep the reserves to pay any claims that come in after the schools leave their pool, and this will leave a significant impact, negative financial impact, for schools currently in service cooperatives. We believe that this bill creates adverse selection. School districts are at a unique risk as a pool that needs to be carefully considered. Due to higher utilization, older demographics, school districts on average are about 10% higher than the typical risk pool. By pooling all school districts together and segregating them from other healthy pools that exist in insurance companies today, you will create a situation where individuals who are healthy or who have more affordable coverage available through a spouse will leave the district altogether. Because this legislation does not require all employees to stay in the pool, it is very likely that you will end up with an insurance industry death spiral, as we call it. We would also point out that this legislation does not require school districts that don't currently offer coverage to bring their teachers in and thereby cover the group that you've been told about who don't currently have coverage. House File 464 sets up a system where the incentive is only for the sicker, higher-cost groups to participate, not the entire population of teachers in the state of Minnesota. As a result, we believe the cost of coverage will be higher for those in the system and eventually cause that death spiral I mentioned. Healthier districts will not participate, period. There will be teachers in local bargaining units who would rather receive cash in lieu because they can obtain health care coverage at a lower rate elsewhere. Mr. Chairman, you've heard descriptions from Mr. Johnson of the blue books behind you, but those are not just fantasies. I spent 2 years of my life when I came to Preferred One as an employee in 1994 working to establish an insurance company license. We were required to get a $3 million cash check in give that over to an account that the commissioner would have access to before we started business. But in order to get our license, we were also required to get a $20 million guarantee from our two companies that started us, Fairview and North Memorial, to have money in the bank to take care of people on the first day of business. This legislation does not contain that, nor does it contain any of the other consumer protections that we have worked so hard to clarify and to make sure that consumers have in this state. Those include appeals mechanisms, so that you have an appellate mechanism within your health plan and an appellate mechanism to the commissioner or an appellate mechanism outside of that. Mr. Chairman, this does not include any of the mandated benefits that we require in state legislation. It does not include having admitted assets restricted so that we know where reserves are being invested. It does not include continuation or conversion privileges. It does not include mandates like family therapy. It doesn't include mandates like second opinion, required out-of-area conversion, services associated with clinical trials, required replacement coverage, geographic accessibility, examinations and audits by the state departments, filings for the NAIC blank so that you know where those financials are. We also believe this legislation does absolutely nothing to achieve any real savings in health care. Pooling does not by itself lower health care costs. Insurers already pool risk. The pools of Medica, Health Partners, and Blue Cross are large pools that we have in our state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and members, the way to address health care costs is to address utilization, negotiated rates with providers, technologies, inefficiencies in the system, trying to work with our aging population, and changing lifestyles. This proposal merely shifts money around, creating other marginal improvements for some districts while forcing other districts, many of which have successfully employed market reforms to bring their health care costs under control, to pay more health care costs. The proposal's claim to save over $223 million over a six-year period is incredibly overstated. A part of this savings is based on the presumption that the pool would not pay all of the MCHA assessment, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association assessment. At lines 4.1, it indicates that the board is a contributing member of an MCHA and would pay the assessments made in MCHA as required by law. But later in the bill at 5.7, the bill specifically caps the amount of the MCHA assessment that would be paid. My understanding of this legislation is the rate was chosen to reflect the percentage of pools that are currently fully funded and therefore paying into the MCHA assessment. But it fails to address the fact that the MCHA assessment will grow and change based on those that are in the pool. It also makes the same type of exemption for the Minnesota Care Premium Tax. Education Minnesota's proposal is seeking $5 million in funding from the general fund to get this pool up and going. Last year's bill asked for $3 million. This is a 40% increase in the appropriation. The appropriation is to be used for startup costs, but as I've said, does not include reserves. No other commercial entrant into the marketplace would receive such special financial treatment. We certainly did not when we started our new health plan. Mr. Chairman and members, before I came over for the first hearing on this bill, I spoke with my client, Mr. Merz, who's the CEO of Preferred One. And I said these words to the other committees that we've heard it in, but I'll say it to you again. He asked me to tell you that if you've read this legislation and you aren't afraid of it, you have not read this legislation carefully enough. Mr. Chairman and members, if there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I appreciate your time and attention this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf or against the bill before us? Please come down now. Otherwise, I believe we're ready for questions.
I don't see any questions, Mr. Chair. What Representative Sturdich, you have proven to be a little bit popular this evening. Your presence is requested for a brief meeting by the Speaker, and I think you should probably see her. Get in the way of your meeting with the Speaker, but if I can see you for a minute before you run up there, what we'll do, DFL members, we're going to visit in 5:46. My goal is to come back at 7:30. And if there's, are you guys going to be someplace where I can, if it's going to be longer than, when I hear a short meeting with the Speaker, I always wonder, if it's going to be longer than that, is there someplace where we can find you, Kirk?
Well, let's see, take your pick. 500 North of Public Safety, 10 for tax, no, we'll be up on third floor, 315, Mr. Chairman.
315, all right, we'll let you know if it's going to be longer than that.
Right.
Representative Sir?
Mr. Chair, I know there's the other balls in the air, so I apologize for that inconvenience we're getting close to, and I think you've seen that Ways and Means Committee's meeting tomorrow on the budget resolution, so I apologize for that, but I'm trying to get a few things done at the same time, so I appreciate your patience, Mr. Chair and members.
Yes, yeah. Representative Simpson.
Our testifiers will, I assume, be back. We have some questions I think we'd like to have answered.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. And to the folks here, I apologize. Anybody that's in the room knows we're up against targets and deadlines and all kinds of stuff right now. If you can stick around for questions, we'd sure appreciate it. We apologize for any inconvenience that it may cause you. We'll be back hopefully in 20, 25 minutes. Thank you. Representative Sturdich, welcome back.
Chair,
hopefully your meetings went well.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Zeller.
Yeah, I was wondering, since we've got the opportunity and never wanted to pass up just an absolute perfect timing opportunity, would Representative Sturdich, Majority Leader Sturdich, like to announce the budget targets for us right here?
Yeah. Right here now?
Break it right here.
Mr. Chair, because of how I was tardy in this committee and made you guys wait, I think I got your committee target doubled here for this committee. So that's a little bit arduous and up there.
Thanks, Representative Sturdich. We did, independent of you, pass a budget of several hundred million dollars. And so now I guess it's twice that. So we're all set. Good deal. We can... And, folks, we can certainly... by the way, pizza's on you. That we'll take that out of the... we have, folks, and I appreciate also everybody sticking around for potential questions. My suggestion might be, since I see this wad of dead trees that have become several amendments, that perhaps we ought to take some amendments and sort of see what the flavor of the conversation is. We won't close down the testimony if there's questions that come up along the way. But, Representative Zellers, my guess is that a number of these might be generated by you or members of your team, and if you'd like to offer them, now would be a swell time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the A13 amendment by Representative Anderson be the first on the list.
Representative Anderson moves the A13 amendment. Representative Anderson, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sturdich, I've got the A13 amendment. If you look on page 3, line 18, it just adds the language that the board must offer only coverage that is fully insured unless it has reserves of at least $200 million. We heard tonight some testimony from different groups, including one of the members from the Minnetonka School Board, Kathy May, and I believe the other person was Phil Griffin, on the concern over having reserves, just to make sure that we protect the employees and that they aren't left in the lurch down the road. And so what this amendment does is it places a reserve of $200 million to address that concern.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Sturdich, any response to that?
I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sturdich. Any other comments or questions? Representative Ellis?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Representative Anderson.
Could I have a roll call on that?
You certainly may, Representative Anderson. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ellis.
Would you mind terribly if I called Mr. Gross down to just explain the solvency issue? We had a little bit of a discussion. I think he kept it short in case there was this type of amendment. Just to explain the issue of having the $200 million, $150 million in place.
Not a problem at all. Mr. Gross, welcome back.
Thank you, Chairman. What is the question again?
Oh. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, we heard testimony earlier this evening about how much was going to be needed in reserves in order to fully fund this without completely putting on the backs of whomever. I guess we're actually not sure who this would be put on if we don't have the funds there, if the fund were to go insolvent or the taxpayers, the teachers, the state, whomever, but just the need for this amount of money to be held in reserve so that the fund can not only stay solvent but also keep the increases from the insurers, the teachers in this case.
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, the $200 million, is that the number?
Yes, Mr.
That would be more than adequate.
And Mr. Gross, Representative Zellers.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, could you explain again, just I think your testimony is a little briefer the last time, but why it's necessary?
For any entity to assume, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zeller, for any entity to assume health care risk, the Commerce Department is always going to try to make sure that you have enough dollars in there for claims, obviously current claims, incurred but not reported claims, et cetera, et cetera. Our actuary, Julia Phillips, looked at this and analyzed it, looking at 200,000 lives, $1 billion in claims every year, and figured you need at least a minimum of $150 million. That would be something that if an insurance company wanted to market health insurance in Minnesota today, we would require at least $150 million in reserves.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Other comments? Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a few questions I wanted to ask you from the department here, and being he's down here, I think I'll do so now if that's all right. I think you stated earlier that the department was neutral on this issue, and I find that interesting because isn't the department responsible for the oversight of all insurance?
Just gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we are, but the way this bill is constructed, we don't have much role in it.
Representative Simpson.
Mr. Chair, if this becomes law, will you have much role in it?
Mr. Chairman, no. Well, the only thing that we get to do is when they appoint the 14 members for the board, we convene a meeting. We then there's going to be $5 million in loan that they receive. We send that money to the group that creates the pool, and the group that creates the pool. And ultimately, there's going to be six different products, insurance products, policies created, and we get to approve those, but that's the extent of our regulation of this new pool.
Mr. Chair.
Gross, Representative Simpson.
Well, if this pool becomes a reality and it becomes law, and 2 years from now or a year from now it becomes defunct and there's not the solvency in it, who's going to be liable for that at that time?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's a good question.
Well,
because the state is.
Mr. Chair, as you represent the Department of Commerce, I would think you'd have a better answer than that's a good question.
Mr. Chairman, members, if that's why I was hinting around that if the amendment that was put on the bill in the Senate that actually gave us the authority to police from moment, you know, from the start until the end of the company or the pool's reserve, that's what we would appreciate. Because then we can monitor on a quarterly basis and an annual basis like we currently do with all health carriers to make sure that the entity is solvent and remains solvent.
So, Mr. Chair, to that point, you do have an opinion then?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes, we do, that we would like to see the Commerce Department, like we do with all other entities, have some role in making sure that the entity that's assuming health care risk remains solvent.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Representative Paulson.
I was going to ask if Mr. Griffin would come down.
Griffin, will you return to the...
Mr. Chairman, while Mr. Griffin returns, I'd like to introduce our six and a half vote. Benson the second.
Finally,
Burns the second, I should say.
Representative Burns, you desire to introduce your smarter counterpart of
Burns. Yeah. this is Lincoln, and he came tonight to drop that off at the airport, but we went a little late, so we're going to probably get a different flight. But he's here. He's three, and his brother and sister, I think, might be coming down, too. They're 1 and 5 months. They're out in the car right now.
So you're going to improve the IQ level in the room.
We are.
Yeah. Well, welcome, Lincoln. We're happy to have you here with us tonight.
Mr. Chair, if Lincoln is the extra half vote on this side, I just want to remind Lincoln that those cookies, I brought those cookies for you.
Glad to have you with us, Lincoln.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Griffin, you had stated in some testimony, you obviously have a lot of experience. You talked about 2 years, I think, with Preferred One, I think it was. And, I mean, this amendment that Representative Anderson is offering for the reserves, and we heard some testimony from yourself and Mr. Straczynski, I believe, on this. I mean, does this make sense? Would this ease your comfort level if this was put on there a little bit? I'm just curious.
Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Phil Griffin, representing Preferred One, the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman, this moves in the direction of what we were suggesting to try and make sure that you have a solvent group. The problem is that this is moving in that direction. It doesn't get you there. As you just heard Mr. Gross describe, the statutes that Mr. Johnson was pointing to set up a whole series of regulations, and included in that is solvency. But solvency isn't just having the money in reserves. It also means having the ability for the commissioner to come in and make sure that you have those investments deposited and invested in assets that really are governed by a national form that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has set out, so that you don't end up with reserves being invested in junk bonds, and when time comes to roll out a health policy or a plan goes bankrupt and you have incurred but not reported liabilities, you have money to pay those, and they're around. It also gives the commissioner the authority to step in if a plan in its quarterly filings isn't solvent or is going the wrong direction. They can put you into a system where they have you report on a monthly basis, and if things get worse enough, they can come in and take over the plan, which we've had happen. And I don't want to belabor this, but there are members around the committee table that were here in 1988 when we had health plans that went insolvent, and the Commissioner of Commerce had to step in. And at that time, one of the health plans went bankrupt. It was called the Moore HMO, and it was up on the range, and it had no money. The Commissioner of Commerce stepped in and told one of the other health plans, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, you have to take over this plan so that the doctors and hospitals get paid in this community. And when they stepped in, they were able to do that. But if you ask somebody to come in and step in and take over 200,000 lives, there's nobody large enough to swallow that in this marketplace today. I'm going on, but I feel strongly about this issue, and I really think that the members need to think carefully as you move forward with this to make sure that you don't move out of this, we call it a maze of regulations sometimes, but it's there not to protect the insurance company, it's not there to protect the employer, it's there to protect the employee and the person who gets their health care coverage through the plan. I'm sorry that was a longer answer that you probably
Mr. Wanted. Chair, Mr. Griffin, I took some notes. I mean, I understand that. You said it was in the 80s that
yes.
took place? And it was Mike Hatch, the commissioner, who stepped in at that time?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, a roll call has been requested. I'm sorry, was there anything else? Seeing none, a roll call has been requested. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzal.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney. De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
Nice.
Sure. Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly.
Mahoney?
No.
Mullery? Mullery? Paulson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Simpson?
Yes.
Tilbury?
No.
Zellers?
Aye.
There being seven nays and six ayes, the motion does not prevail. Next.
Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like to offer the A-20 amendment.
Representative Anderson offers the A-20 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, I had a great opportunity today. I was visited by the Hopkins School District, and I told them they couldn't have picked a better day to come and visit me, because one of the issues they wanted to talk to me about was this bill that we have before us. And they expressed grave concerns about the different liabilities that are out there with this and how that would impact them and their budget and trying to plan ahead and things of that nature. And what they cited to me was kind of an alarming statistic here. The state of New Jersey actually has the second largest insurance pool in the nation with 740,000 participants. And a legislative task force found costs are expected to double in that pool by 2010 with an unfunded liability of $20 billion. And so what I'm trying to do here with this amendment that I have here is to make sure that we're protected against any unfunded liabilities and that we don't have that outlined there and that in the end that the entire state of Minnesota has to pay for these and try and bail them out if we run into those problems later on. So that's the gist of it.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I keep forgetting. Could I have a roll call on this?
Absolutely, please? Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Is there or are there further comments or questions? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Enzo.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney. Dabney. De La Force?
Yes.
Dominguez. Dominguez. Johnson?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Lilly? Lilly? Mahoney?
No.
Mullery? Mullery? Paulson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Simpson?
Yes.
Tilbury?
No.
Zellers?
Aye.
There being seven nays and six ayes, the motion does not prevail. Are there any other amendments desired to be offered? Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, there's an amendment in the packet. I'll offer the A6 amendment.
Representative Paulson offers the A6 amendment. Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, I'll just ask for a roll call. And, Mr. Chair, this amendment is somewhat based on the testimony that was made by Mr. Gross earlier from the department in terms of having the Department of Commerce have some regulatory oversight over this. And as was mentioned, I think that's the duty of the Department of Commerce. And I know that this volunteer pool, it's a volunteer pool, actually, in Wisconsin, from what I understand and what I know about it. It's not the case of Representative Sertich's offering here today. But I understand that there is oversight in the state of Wisconsin, even over that voluntary pool, is my understanding. And so I'm not sure what the exact language is that the Senate put on that Mr. Gross had referred to. I didn't model this after that Senate version, but this would allow the department to have some oversight to make sure that there are national standards that are being filed, to make sure there is solvency, to make sure that this does not end up in a similar situation as was the result of the Minneapolis teachers that we had to unfortunately step in last year, Mr. Chairman. The legislature had to step in a very uncomfortable situation, I think, with some other teachers didn't necessarily approve. I don't think we want to go down that same route, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Is there anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to this amendment? Representative Burns.
Yeah, I think this is a great amendment, and I'm glad you offered it, Representative Paulson. I think we need to really look at the people we're trying to protect, and some people would say we're regulating too much in the insurance area, but a lot of other folks say
when we regulate insurance through our Commerce Department, we are doing our best to make sure that we protect those people. And in this case, we're protecting our teachers and other school employees if this plan does go into effect. I think that makes sense, and I would urge support of the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Burns. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this amendment?
Can you ask if the author supports the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Representative Surge, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just seeing it for the first time, reading it briefly, and I know we discussed this in the last committee as well, at least the bottom section of this, and I oppose it.
Thank you, Representative Surge. Other comments, questions? Seeing none, a roll call has been requested. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzalk. Anzalk. Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Yes.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being 8 nays and 6 ayes, the motion does not prevail. Are there any other amendments? Seeing none.
I think, Mr. Chairman.
Good try.
I'm still waiting. Do you have any amendments you desire to offer?
Yes.
I believe
I have the A18 amendment.
Representative Burns offers the A18 amendment and asks for a roll call, Representative Burns.
Yes, Chair.
All right, Representative Burns, to your amendment.
This amendment limits the pool to active employees only. I think when we're jumping into something so big, we want to make sure we are adequately preparing for health care benefits for our retiree members. And we have heard in the state about some unfunded liabilities that some of our school districts and some of our municipalities have. And if we're going to jump in, I want to make sure that we do it in a thoughtful way.
Okay.
So I would say if this bill is going to pass, I have a lot of reservations about it, but if it does pass, let's make sure we take it one step at a time.
Thank you, Representative Burns. Are there any comments or questions with respect to the A18 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzalk. Anzalk. Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
Excuse me, I didn't hear that. No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being 8 nays and 6 ayes, that motion does not prevail. The amendment does not prevail. Are there other amendments? Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. We've attempted here to not only save the taxpayers, to save the folks that are going to be issuing this plan with assets, with reserves, giving the folks at Commerce who do this on a regular basis the oversight they have on just about every other insurance plan. Looks like we've failed in all those attempts, so at the last best resort is to save the poor teachers and school employees from rate increases. And the A1 amendment limits that premium rate increase to no more than 3% during a 2-year period.
Representative Zellers, do you desire a roll call with respect to that?
I would, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
A roll call has been asked for. Is there further comments or questions? Seeing none, clerk, roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzalk. Anzalk. Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being 8 nays and 6 ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there additional amendments?
Chair, I will offer the 829 amendment.
Representative Paulson offers the 829 amendment.
Yes, for roll call.
And the roll call has been asked for. Representative Paulson, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, this amendment simply would allow any collective bargaining unit of the employees that would be eligible for the pool to opt out. And so there still is a strong incentive to have a large pool that I think Representative Surge has presented in his bill. We've also heard testimony tonight, I believe it was from Stillwater, that there is some opposition by some school districts. And so this would give an opt-out. I mean, you'd have to have a majority vote to opt out. And, I mean, that's essentially the amendment, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Mr. Chair, if Education Minnesota, if they have a, if they care to testify, if they support this or not on this amendment, because this might be something that they're supporting their membership, they get an opt-out opportunity, they may be supportive of this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Representative Sertich, I know that you've been in touch with them as well as several others. You know what the support, oppose, and what would be your ascertainment of where everybody else is at?
Sure. I oppose the amendment, but that's not the question Representative Paulson asked. I have spoke to Education Minnesota, and they do oppose this amendment. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Representative Sertich. Other comments, questions? A roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call a roll, please.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzalk. Anzalk. Burns.
Aye.
Daphne.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers. Zellers.
There being 8 nays and 4 ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Representative Paul.
I'll offer the 814 amendments, which I believe is next to members' packets, and ask for a roll call. Members, this is a very similar amendment, but this would allow school boards to opt out if the school boards determine that that is the case. And I think that we have a lot of talk around here about unfunded mandates, about giving local control, whether it's on property taxes or other issues. We've heard that mantra a lot, and this allows those locally elected officials to make that decision. And I would at least think that members of the committee would support allowing our school boards to make that decision.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Are there comments or questions with respect to the 814 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzalk. Anzalk. Burns.
Aye.
Daphne.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being 8 nays and 5 ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there further amendments? Representative Zellers.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
Representative Zellers offers the A2 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In talking about this over the last, actually, it's, I was going to say months, but it's been years, and my neighbor next door on the left-hand side is a homeschooler, the next to them a homeschooler, and next to down the street are homeschoolers all in one block, and in discussing this with them, said, you know, they maybe something that they'd actually be interested in as a homeschooler that maybe wouldn't have an opportunity. So if it's for the teachers, whether it's a private school or a homeschooler, mom or dad at home teaching their kids is still technically a teacher. We want to include all teachers in this pool. So I thought it'd be an opportunity to not only help out the teachers, but help out my neighbors as well, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Comments or questions? Representative Paulson?
Mr. Chair, just asked for a roll call, and I think this would make the pool even bigger, which is one of the arguments we've heard about having that effort to make the pool bigger and spread the risk out.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Other comments or questions? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call a roll.
Atkins.
Chair votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzo.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
Dale Forrest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye. There being nine nays and five ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Representative Zellers, to your amendment, the A3.
Well, as we've talked on many occasions, there are some folks who've not liked the plan, not liked the program, are concerned about the risk. In this case, the charter schools may or may not want an option to opt out. We want to give them that option in the bill, Mr. Chairman. If they manage their plan well, and in most cases they have, we want to make sure they can keep those premiums low for their teachers and employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman,
may I ask for a roll call?
A roll call has been asked for. Is there further comments or questions with respect to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, clerk, call a roll.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Hands up.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye. There being nine nays and six ayes, the amendment does not prevail.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like to offer the A27 amendment.
Representative Anderson offers the A27 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, again, this is in communications that I've had with the school districts in my area. As I mentioned earlier, I spoke with the Hopkins School District, and one other statistic that they gave me regarding the New Jersey insurance pool that they have is that considering that insurance costs are going to double, there have been 30% of the New Jersey school districts that have abandoned the pool altogether. And I think that speaks volumes about what will happen with this bill down the road. So the Hopkins School District is one of the schools that are included in this amendment to give them the option to opt out of this. Then the other one also is my Wayzata School District, and I'm fortunate enough to have with me here today two school board members from the Wayzata School District. I have Carter Peterson and Susan Drogemiller, and I don't know if they wanted to come and testify or give some comments of why they have concerns about this bill, but they're more than welcome to do that. The other issue, too, is as I was on one of our recesses that we had, I had received an email from my teachers' union in the Wayzata School District stating their vehement opposition to this legislation. They're very concerned about it, where they, while they recognize the concerns of other school districts that are in need, they do not support the mandatory portion of this legislation. And so that's why I want to give them the opt-out from this legislation. I've included those two school districts, and I hope that members would respect that and vote in favor of this amendment. But I have Ms. Peterson here. She wants to add her comments, too.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Welcome to the committee.
Carter Peterson, Wayzata School District. Wayzata, I actually live in Wayzata. I didn't come prepared to talk, so I just want to give you a little history for us. And I wasn't on the board at the time. I'm in my fifth year. It's before that point we had a health committee that was set up of our teachers, our administration, and our staff about looking at our health care. It was out of control. And as a result, we decided, including the staff, that we would go to become self-insured. As a result of that, we have gone, our healthcare has gone down remarkably. But I think, and as a result, we were allowed to put more money on the salary schedule, and that was the trade-off for our teachers. And that's one of my fears here. This thing skyrockets, which it sounds like it will, at least for us, that will affect our teachers, which is who we're here talking about. But over and above that, the other thing, and I think somebody hinted at it today, is tonight. Tonight. We started it today. We're now at tonight. So, I know, you guys have been here since 8, but I actually was at another one at 8, too. So, anyway, but the other thing that I want to talk about is one of the reasons we're controlling it is our teachers are involved. We're sitting there, one of the things they're doing a little contest to walk across America, okay? So they got a prize for that. They're in because they also know if they save money, they've saved money for each other. That's not going to happen with a statewide plan. It's just not going to happen. And as a result, everything you read about healthcare, what controls costs is when people know that it means something to them personally. We will lose that, and it has been very important. And as a result, the other thing, when I'm here, I'm going to say something. One of the things why we really need to do it, and why I said, I know you've heard about, but this cost control, it's very expensive for our teachers to live close to our district. It's so terrible. This is one way we've learned to control costs to help them pay for that. So I have to tell you, this is could be a disaster for us, and this will affect our teachers. I don't make enough money. It doesn't matter. So, anyway, enough.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Again, I forgot the roll call. If you could put that on there, too, please.
Absolutely, Representative Anderson. Are there other comments or questions with respect to the A27 amendment? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Andrew.
Yes. No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dot. Representative Burns, could you repeat that, please? I'm sorry, I didn't hear
Aye.
You. Dabney.
No.
De La Forest.
Yes.
Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being 9 nays and 6 ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there additional amendments?
I believe Representative Burns has
A28. Representative Burns offers the A28 amendment. Representative Burns, do you want a roll call with respect to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
To your amendment, Representative.
Thank you. This is the same amendment as Representative Anderson just offered with some different school districts. School districts that I represent, we've heard from two of them tonight. You've heard from the Wayzata School District, School Board Member Carter Peterson, and you've already heard testimony from our Minnetonka School District, Lisa Wagner and Kathy Mays. I think what we need to remember, members, is allow our school districts to do a better job on the local level. They can do that. They would not be opposed to a plan if it did not require mandatory participation. We need to keep costs down. They have done it. They have less healthcare costs for their teachers and employees, and they also happen to be healthier. due to their proactive action, and that's important. I also believe we should respect these particular collective bargaining units. I know we have a lot of respect for that across the aisle. They are smart people. They have looked into this issue, and they don't want this. Both the Wayzata and the Minnetonka School District Teachers Unions are very concerned about this particular proposal. I think what we need to do is work on health care reform for everybody in Minnesota, including teachers and school employees. I'm ready to do that. I'm not sure this helps, and I'd ask that the committee allow these school districts, if they choose to opt out. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Burns. Are there other comments or questions with respect to the 828 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Hands up.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Daphne.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney. Mahoney. Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Sellers.
Aye.
There being eight nays and five ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there other amendments, Representative Zellers?
I'd like to offer the 826 amendment, Chairman, and ask for a roll call.
The 826 amendment has been offered by Representative Zellers. Is it in everyone's possession? And ask for a roll call. Representative Zellers, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is District 279, the other district I represent. This is Representative Anderson and Burns in the Wayzata School District. Again, looking out for the teachers and employees in my school district, if this goes into effect, they're going to see a premium increase. They're going to see a rate increase. It's going to be money out of their pockets, notwithstanding some of the other problems that we have with fund insolvency, any number of issues. I just want to make sure that my teachers and school employees are held harmless. And I ask for a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Are there other comments or questions with respect to the 826 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Hands up.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Daphne.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being nine nays and five ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there other amendments?
I do, Mr. Chairman. The A-22 amendment.
The Representative Zellers offers the A-22 amendment. Representative Zellers, to your amendment.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'd ask for a roll call, please. We tried several times to save our school districts, to save other school districts, to let every other district out, and we tried 3%, and I understand that may be within some when health care costs go up, that may be within the margins, so to give them a little wiggle room. The amendment says that we won't allow premiums to increase more than 10% in a two-year period. Again, this is an amendment that if we're not going to have some of these things in place, if somebody's going to have to pay for these costs, it's not going to be the teachers and employees. Mr. Chairman, I ask for the members' vote on this. Folks, we're talking about the teachers. This is going to be coming out of their pockets. If in all worst-case scenario this happens, your teachers are going to be looking at serious increases in their costs and their health care. This isn't just a metro-rural. This is all over the state of Minnesota. Everybody's going to have to pay the cost on this. I don't think 10% is too much to ask for to keep your teachers from being added on to taken out of their paychecks every year, every week, every month.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Are there other comments or questions with respect to the 822 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzup.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
Being nine nays and five ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Are there additional amendments?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'll offer the A23 amendment. We're not going to spare them complete misery. We might as well go with complete and utter misery. This limits the premium rate increases to 25%. We're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars a year now for our teachers and for the folks who are working in our schools. If we're not going to do at least a mere 10%, this is an absolute possibility. A 25%, a 30, 40% increase in what they're paying in rates is a distinct possibility. Folks, we're going to have to do something to help save our teachers. Again, if 3, 6, 10, 25% is a bare minimum, some of these folks aren't going to be able to afford to pay their premiums if this the actual doomsday scenarios come out. And I don't think you want to go home and tell your teachers and the employees working in your schools that 10% wasn't enough, and by golly, at least 25% I can save you that you know, be doubling your premiums every month. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for a roll call, if you would please.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Are there other comments, questions with respect to the A23 amendment? Seeing none, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins.
No.
Anderson.
Aye.
Anzup.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Knuth.
No.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
No.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Simpson.
Aye.
Tilbury.
No.
Zellers.
Aye.
There being nine nays and five ayes, the amendment does not prevail. There are additional amendments. Representative Paulson.
We'll call the bill.
Does anyone else desire to offer any amendments? Seeing none, a roll call has been requested with respect to the bill. Representative Sertich, do you have any parting comments before we send you on your way?
Thank you, members, and I once again apologize for the interruptions in the middle. But thank you for your time and for the public who stayed through it all.
And I would echo Representative Sertich's comments. Thank you all very much for your patience. The chair takes full responsibility for the length and number of interruptions that we went through, though I do not take responsibility for all the amendments that were offered. Appreciate your patience and understanding. With that, a roll call has been asked for. Clerk, call the roll, please. To the bill.
Atkins.
Chair votes aye.
Anderson.
No.
Anzup.
Yes.
Burns.
No.
Dabney. Dabney. De La Forest. De La Forest. Dominguez.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knuth.
Yes.
Lilly. Lilly. Mahoney.
Yes.
Mullery. Mullery. Paulson.
Aye. Start it with me.
It's been a long day.
You missed all these amendments, Mr. Chair.
You're an Antel, I tell you.
Yes. Yes.
Representative Paulson votes no.
Peterson.
Yes.
Simpson.
No.
Tilbury.
Yes.
Zellers.
No.
And on the chair's renewal of the motion that House File 464 be recommended to pass, we refer to the Committee on Finance. There are eight ayes and five nays. The bill does prevail. Representative Sertich, thank you for visiting with us this afternoon, and good luck in your travels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate it.
Members, thank you. With that, we stand adjourned. Have a good weekend.